Hello. Yes, good day. My name is Rasmus. I will be the one torturing you for the next 6 hours if you last that long on PHP. And actually, I wanted to show one thing that you may not have caught in your program. And I get to use this funky device, too. And some... Yes, how do I do that? This is too fancy. All right, lights, let's see. Lights, main light down. Perfect? All right. All right, so in your programs, right near the beginning, right after the actual schedule of talks and stuff, there is a little quote at the bottom of the page from me. I hate programming. And it's really true, and I usually tell people that all the time. And that'll be a recurring theme today, is my hatred of programming. So, the slides, whoops, let me switch. No? Yes, all right, there we go. The slides are not there yet. I was actually hoping to put it somewhere local on the FTP server, but I didn't get in touch with an organizer and get that figured out yet. So they will be there. Check the FTP server. If you see something like php1.pdf or something, it will be local on the FTP server. I'll try that tonight. I used to put my email address on here. I've stopped doing that. I get 1,500 emails a day. A lot of the questions about PHP that are on the mailing list or in the manual, it gets a little bit annoying getting sort of personal email from people asking me PHP questions. Try the mailing list, try the news groups. There are all kinds of places where you can get information about PHP, but we'll talk about that further. Scroll back to 1993 or so. I must have written 500 CGI bin programs in C, maybe 1,000. I don't really expect you to read this, but this is the CGI bin program written in C. It's very fancy. It puts up a form that asks the user for their name and their age. So this was the general web problem I wanted to solve. I wanted to put up a form where people could type in their name and their age and then do something with that information. In this case, I'm not doing much with the information. All I'm doing is parsing it a little bit and then displaying it back to them, saying, hi, your name, you are this many years old. This is a lot of code to do something that simple. And if I wanted to change the look of my form a little bit, change the color of the background or something, I have to go into my C program, recompile it, redeploy it on the web server, and it just didn't work, especially when I started doing more complex sites where I had somebody else doing the HTML markup for me, and my responsibility was the business logic. That was the problem I was trying to solve back in 93. 10 years ago now, it's pretty scary. The whole world seemed to migrate towards using Perl for doing this. And Lincoln Stein had a CGI.pm, which is a way of writing CGIs in Perl. And the same problem solved in Perl looked like this. And to a programmer, great, this is very structured, this is very logical. You can almost read it like English. Start the HTML, an H1 tag that has my example form in it. Start your form, a name text field, an age text field with P tags in between them, a submit button, end the form. If there are parameters, grab the parameters and print them out. Hi, your name, you're this many years old. End the HTML. Great. Except not so great, because this is the business logic, basically, of this particular application. And if I hand this off to somebody and they want to change the background color, how do they change the background color? They click on their front page, change background color, right? Front page doesn't understand Perl. Teaching the HTML jockey Perl was not my idea of fun. And it happens. I mean, does anyone in here know how to change the background color of this form? Nobody, really. Usually there's one or two geeks that have written CGIs in Perl. But it happens that it's an argument to the start HTML function call, that you can actually put in the background color in that function call. But here, I mean, that's a complete jumble of layout and the business logic. It's all put together in one, and you have to know Perl to do any part of this particular problem. What I wanted is not quite as pretty, but much more functional for my uses. I wanted the HTML to look like HTML. So up until here in this particular code, it's just normal HTML. Stuff that an HTML authoring tool like FrontPage or Dreamweaver or any of those tools will spit out. Then when I wanted something slightly dynamic, I wanted to toss in the tags at that point. So in this particular case, if there is something in the name field, echo out the name and the age, and if. So that was sort of what I was striving towards. Initially, I didn't have any business logic, or I had no conditional tags in PHP at all. The very first version of PHP was just sort of a macro template system that would replace a string with something from my C library. So I had taken all this C code that I had written over the years, made a single C library, and then exposed those functions to my HTML templates by coming up with various keywords. And you would put a keyword in there between bracket, question mark, the keyword, question mark, bracket, and it would make a function call into my C library and replace that macro with that, with the result of the function call. There was no business logic. The if tag came later when I used this system in a real-world application. And the HTML designer I was working with was a little bit too smart. She came to me and said, look, this is nice and fine, and every time we need to do some business logic, we ask you, you write it in C, you tell us what tag it is, and it's sort of like an extended set of HTML. I would give them a cheat sheet, and I said, okay, you know your normal HTML, here are another 40 tags that you can put in your page that do something that's specific to the application that we're working on. Whenever they needed to do something new, I would write the code in C and say, okay, here's the tag you use for this particular operation. But she came to me and said, well, we're now starting to get hit by different types of browsers, and we need to send different HTML based on which browser is hitting the page. So back then, Mosaic would come in, then the new Netscape would come in, and we have to send slightly different HTML. And she very cleverly argued that this is not a business logic decision. This is a presentation layer logical decision that needs to be made. So she, at her level, needed to be able to do, if Mozilla, if Mosaic, do this, otherwise do that. So she wanted an if tag. I said, well, okay, fine. I can take my little simple state machine that I had written that was either in HTML mode or inside parsing this macro tag, and add another state that says, okay, now we have an if condition. So I gave her the if condition. She came back 2 minutes later. I need else as well. Okay, right. So another state, now we have an else. Probably 2 hours later, she came back and said, this is nice, but I also have this bit of HTML that I keep displaying over and over again. Can't I sort of assign that to a tag and maybe even have a loop? Well, it makes sense. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to be able to put the header of your web application in a function so you can call header and footer, so you can separate that out into a separate file, and across your 1,000 web pages on your site, you can just call header and footer and then define that design and layout in one separate file. So changing one file would then affect the 1,000 pages on your site. So she came back with all these ideas, and yeah, I guess it makes perfect sense. So my little state machine that used to have two states grew and grew and grew and grew. And I had absolutely no idea how to write a language. I had never read a book on compilers. I had never taken a computer science course in my life. I have an engineering degree and have 18 years of calculus or something, but computer science, nah. I mean, I knew how to program enough to sort of get by, and it never really interested me. And I really do honestly hate programming. It's really, really painful thing to sit and do. I love solving problems. And unfortunately, a lot of problems can be solved by programming. And that's sort of why PHP came to be. I found it way too tedious to write all these programs in C. And even in Perl, I found it way too tedious. I found the syntax way too complex. What I needed was what basically PHP has become today is sort of the basic of the web. I mean, you can write anything you want, and it makes sense. You can read other people's code, and for the most part, you can read through it. PHP hasn't gotten so complex that it really takes someone with a computer science degree to figure it out. And that's really the whole point, to let everyone solve the web problem. So this is sort of how things evolved from long ago. When I sat there, I built my state machine. It got more and more states. At a certain point along the way, I figured that maybe I should try to read a little bit about this stuff, because my state machine was falling apart. Somebody wanted recursion, for example, Recursion, why would you want recursion in a web application? I mean, like drawing fractals, or what are you doing? But they wanted recursion. I looked at my state machine, like, well, it's just looping back to the same state, big deal, right? So I added that. And I didn't have any concept of static functionally scoped variables or anything like that, so there's absolutely no way to end the recursion. They didn't ask me for that. They only asked for recursion, and the only way out of it was to kill off the web server process, basically. So after I did that, then they complained, like, okay, yeah, well, I'll figure that out. So I read a little bit, yeah, I guess we have to go sort of the C approach, and we have to have a static keyword, so you can say static I equals 0, for example. So only on the first call to the function will you initiate that variable. But then once I got to that point where I had sort of a main scope, and I had a function scope, and I had static variables, and I had recursion, I mean, it's starting to become a programming language. I resisted that for so long. This was a macro templating system. This was not a programming language. And even after, I had loops, and I had all kinds of stuff in there. No way, this is not a programming language. Larry Wall and Guido van Rossum, they write programming languages. I have absolutely no idea how to write one of these things. But it sort of came along, and it got more and more complex. Then I sat down and read a book on Yak and Flex, well, Yak and Lex back then. I think, hey, this is cool. There's a program where you can just sort of define the grammar of your language, and it will generate all your C code. Perfect. So I sat down. I didn't really understand Lex very well, though. So I sort of skipped the last part of the book where they talked about how to integrate Lex with Yak. And I just did the Yak part. I love my state machine. I think I can do my own Lexer in my state machine, and I'll just parse or pass the tokens. The way Yak works is you define the grammar in a very sort of easy text file format. And the grammar is sort of what is a valid function call, what's the valid syntax of the language. And then you also have a lexical analyzer that goes through a file and picks out keywords, tokens they're called, and assigns them a number. So you get letters IF, for example, space or bracket, that says this is an if token, and it passes the if token off to the Yak parser. And I figured, well, I can parse the damn text file and pass tokens off myself, no problem. I don't need to understand this Lex stuff. So that was PHP version 2. Was my Yak-based grammar plus my own lexical analyzer. That took us to about 1997, so that has been going for about three and a half years, and quite a few people were using it. PHP grew right alongside the net, basically, and very early on. I had built PHP into the NCSA web server, the HTTPD from NCSA. NCSA sort of stalled, and there was no real API. You couldn't really plug modules into NCSA, so people, if they wanted to have it embedded in their web server, would have to download my version of NCSA that had PHP hacked into it. Apache came out, and they had a module API, so you could actually download a generic Apache server and then download my module and plug them together, and it would all work. And that was beautiful, and that sort of really kicked off PHP because everyone switched over to Apache, and there was this PHP module right there available that could do very cool stuff. So I don't think I had a really clear picture back then of sort of why PHP was a good solution. I would like to say I had this nice framework laid out back then, say, okay, this is what I'm going to build, this is why this is a good way to build it. It sort of just came together and it seemed obvious at the time. But over the years, I've sort of come down with, okay, so the aspects of a good solution. And I think PHP has started to meet that it needs to have a really shallow learning curve. There are a lot of people on a lot of tight deadlines, even good programmers that really can sit down and spend a week and build and understand really complex systems. Even they would much prefer not even having to think. Just sit down, 3 minutes later, they've solved their problem. Perfect. And PHP meets that. It's really, really easy to use. If you have a little bit of programming experience, you know PHP. I'm not here to try to change the way anybody programs or change the world of programming. I have stolen and borrowed ideas from all kinds of languages. And so the way I thought things should be done is just the way they're done. So if you have a bit of C background, you can guess your way through PHP. How to get the length of a string, for example, string length. How to get a substring, or is a substring function. Various things like that. So even going back to basic, if there's things that don't exist in C, you sort of all step back, how would you do it in BASIC, or how might you do it in Perl, or even in Java at some points? So the shallow learning curve with instant gratification, that sort of goes together. You try something, if it works right away, then you're encouraged to try the next step. Building on what you know, so boring and stealing from other languages, and going back to the basis that most people have in their programming experience and build on that, and documentation. If you don't document something, you might as well not write the code, at least if you're sort of mass targeting your code. If you don't document it, forget it. The PHP documentation, for those of you who haven't seen it, php.net/manual, it's very, very good. We're in 16 different languages now. It's about a 1,600 page PDF file in 16 different languages. It's just massive. Solve a simple problem easily. You have to be able to just sit down in 2 minutes, solve a problem, and eliminate the tedium of that. And also be able to scale to solve really complex problems. Security, work everywhere. None of this only working on IIS, on NT or something. We work on Windows, we work on QNX, we work on 390 boxes, we work everywhere. And we have no real, I mean, this is a Linux conference, but there's really nothing Linux specific about PHP. Most of it was developed on Linux. I run it on Linux, but you can run it on any operating system you want. It really doesn't matter. And my favorite point is at the bottom, teach the basics by not hiding the problem. There are some other systems out there that make the solving the web problem really easy, sort of on the surface anyway. Cold Fusion is a very good example. They have a very pretty IDE. You can sort of drag and drop and click and point and poof, you've solved your web problem. That's a very limited domain of web problems you can solve that way. And the problem with that is you do two or three, or hey, this is easy, but as soon as you hit one that touches on something that's not quite within the domain of Cold Fusion, it's very, very difficult. Suddenly there's a huge paradigm shift where you can't do it within the IDE, you have to escape down underneath the skirts of the thing and try to figure out the scripting language that's underneath Cold Fusion. And the Cold Fusion scripting language is horrible. It is absolutely uncomprehensible. So you have this huge barrier that suddenly once you hit that wall, you're screwed. You really, really need to be good to then figure out how to go on from there. Whereas with PHP, initially it might be slightly harder because it's not a point-and-click solution, but it's a very, very simple scripting type of solution. So once you get and sort of work your way up from there, there's really no big paradigm shift. You can keep going, keep going, keep going. From the tiniest little site in your own personal page where you just show your cousin your pictures or something, up to the biggest site in the world, Yahoo, which is where I work now, where a lot of Yahoo is now driven by PHP. So it really scales from nothing to huge, huge sites. So back early on, I actually saw PHP a little bit differently. I saw PHP as a wrapper around C and C++ code and an easy way to sort of expose your business logic written in C or C++ to the world via coming up with a tag and saying, okay, here's the tag for this particular functionality. So that was sort of my logic back then, where you had the web server, you had the PHP component, and you link in your actual C code directly in via PHP into the web server. So you had the process here. That was the web server, was PHP, and your business logic written in C or C++. And then you just had the presentation layer in a text file. It might talk to other things like databases. Very few people use PHP this way. And part of it was my fault. When I released PHP, I sort of tried to pitch this idea as, here's a framework so that you can very easily, you can sort of forget about the web part, you can just write your business logic in C or C++ and write it within this framework, and you can then solve it via the web. And I'll take care of all the problems of talking to the web server and dealing with the HTML files and stuff. And people thought, hey, great. And I included a couple of basic functionalities with it, some very common functions that you might need to talk to a database and things like that. And I would get lots of emails back saying, hey, this is really cool, but I really need functions that also talk to this, this, and this. I'm like, well, this is what this is for. Write it. Like, no, but I mean, you know this stuff. You're much quicker at it. Could you just write it for me? And stupidly, I did. And I wrote a lot of this stuff, and people would always say, oh, this is cool, but I just need one more function. Could you also write this particular one? So I kept doing that for probably about a year, all kinds of people from all over the place. And it was sort of an ego thing as well, that, hey, they're cool, they're using my stuff, but all they need is just this one or two more functions. So, okay, fine, half an hour later I had that. I kept going like that, and that sort of, I think, got people in the direction of PHP was not a framework for your business logic written in C. PHP was more a scripting language that has scripting level functions that right in your actual HTML files, you could put this stuff in and you could talk to all kinds of stuff. And then other people joined in and added functionality to PHP, and we have all these extensions that talk to all kinds of stuff, and people now are writing their business logic in PHP, which is a little bit odd because the whole reason for PHP was to separate design and business logic, and now we have template systems for PHP, which really blows my mind because what the heck, we have a template system on top of a template system, and pretty soon, I mean, when do we stop? How many layers of template systems are we going to get? But things have really taken off. These are the December 2002 numbers from Netcraft. We're over 10 million domains now. 28.7% of all the domains on the web. So you're just sort of randomly clicking around, one in four, one in three sites that you hit will be a PHP-powered domain. About a million IP addresses. Obviously, a single machine can have many domains on it. It's a little bit hard to tell whether a site is using PHP or whether they just have it installed. There's really no way for us to tell that. But this also only catches the Apache module version of PHP. There's a lot of ISPs running it as a CGI as well. We can't detect those. So that might balance things out a little bit. The ones that have it installed but aren't using it might balance the ones that we don't see that are using it via CGI. But it's still a pretty good number. It's way above any other scripting technology out there, with perhaps the exception of legacy CGI bins written in Perl. There might be more of those around, but it's way more than ASP or ColdFusion or any of the other technologies. Nice spelling on December there. Security Space, another company that goes out and pokes various servers. They poked 5 million Apache servers in December and saw about half of them have PHP installed. So it's by far the most popular Apache module as well. Little idea of releases. Things have slowed down quite a bit lately. So version 1 was actually not till June 1995. I had early betas and stuff, but I didn't label it 1.0 until about a year and a half after I started the project. It took me a little while. It's very hard for a developer to say, okay, this is 1.0. Everything is finished. The software is never done. You're always tweaking stuff. And that really happened to us with version 2, where I started. So the betas of version 2 were up in the 1.90 something, and I went up to 1.99, figuring, okay, next be 2.0, but nah, I wasn't quite ready, so I went through A, B, C, D, E, F, G. I kept going and going and going. I hit K, I think there was actually an L as well, and then I went through and said, okay, let's call it beta 1. I went through 12 betas. And then I ended up, we started writing PHP 3 before even PHP 2.0 was released. And finally we said, okay, damn it, this is ridiculous. Let's just call it 2.0 and get it out the door. So not till November 1997 did we have 2.0 out the door. And less than a month later, we had the first beta of version 3. So, and then 2.01 and stuff. But it's been going along. The last release was recently, December 27th, PHP 4.3. Most likely the last PHP 4 release. There will be 4.31, 3.2 probably for security fixes and stuff. Yeah, question? Well, there's a big question mark here. Actually, there should be a much bigger question mark. We don't know when PHP 5 will be released. We really don't. There's a lot of work. I have a to-do at the end of the second tutorial today. Big to-do of all the things that we're working on for PHP 5. It's going to take a while. I don't see a beta of that until probably 6 months from now. Final release, maybe not in 2003 at all, maybe at the end of 2003, November, December, perhaps. It's going to take a little while. It's a pretty big project. But 4.3 should really meet all your needs. If at your age you don't have enough in 4.3, then we're in big, big trouble. The main guys behind PHP these days, it's not really giving enough credit to everybody else. We have 770 people with CVS accounts now, I think, for the project. So it's a really, really big project. There are 10 main guys that have sort of been around forever. I've been around the longest, I guess. But when we went from PHP 2 to version 3, I got a little bit tired of PHP by then, and I sort of delegated a lot of things away from myself to the point where I had nothing left to do, and I thought I had to reel stuff back in. I said, wait a second, let me take that back. I'll do something. But I really did delegate a lot of things. The Oracle stuff was really killing me, and one guy had been just pestering me with bug reports about the Oracle stuff, and in the end I just said, look, shut up, it's yours. You know a lot more about it than I do, obviously. Fix it yourself. Here you go. Here's a CVS account. Do whatever you want. And back then, there was a guy named Steve. He got tired of it as well. He delegated to another guy named Teese. And now both of these guys are stuck in the project in a very... they can't get out either. Shane has tried to get out a few times, but he keeps coming back. Andy and Zev were the poor suckers that volunteered to rewrite my actual Yak Lex parsing engine. Two guys, they since started a company called Zend, from Zed-E from Zev, and Andy from Andy. Sam Ruby is this big brain that I met at IBM when I was working there, who does lots of Java stuff. He wrote the Java extension for PHP. He's a very handy guy. Sasha, back then, was this 16-year-old kid in Germany who just knew the autocomp stuff inside out and all kinds of other things as well. The guy is a dictionary of computer knowledge. He's like, I guess, 19 now. And Jim and Andre as well pitched in and did all kinds of good stuff. But you can see we're spread out all over the world. And even after working together for now 6 years for most of these guys, not everyone has met everyone else on this list. I have met everybody, finally, but not everyone has met everyone else, which is kind of interesting. PHPNet website, you should visit it often. There's all kinds of good stuff on there. A lot of the talks that I've given and other people have given, you can find on talks.php.net. I'm working on this is a new presentation system. There's an old site as well called conf.php.net that has a lot of the older talks, but the newer talks are all on talks.php.net. The mailing lists are really, really busy. We gateway them to a news server. You can go to news.php.net either with your browser or with a news reader. So nntp://news.php.net, and you can read mailing lists directly through nntp. We don't block non-subscribers from posting. You'll have to validate your address. First time you email the list, it'll send an email back saying, hey, are you who you are, just to avoid spam. But other than that, you can completely follow the mailing list via your web browser or via nntp and post as well, and sort of join in the conversations. The main general mailing list probably gets around 200 messages a day, so it's a little rough on your mailbox if you subscribe to it if you're not ready for 200 a day. Pear.php.net, we'll talk about Pear later on. Bugs, this is the bug tracking system. If you have a bug, looking for a problem, go to bugs.php.net, do a search, see if you can find other people with the same problem. QA site, quality assurance, whenever we have a new release, the QA team kicks up and really starts testing. And if you want to contribute and don't really know what to do, QA might be a nice way. Just download it, see if stuff works. If it doesn't work, you report a bug. It's not that hard. CVS server, all our code is on there. And a couple of other sites. The snapshots, we have nightly, or every 4 hours actually, we build PHP. We sort of package up the tarball of the source code. We also build the Windows version, and we stick that on there so you can test the latest code via getting stuff from snaps.php.net. All right, enough boring stuff. Some few tips. If you go to php.net/, the name of the function you're looking for, it'll take you directly to the right place in the manual, which is very handy. I wish more sites would do that. At the bottom of every documentation page for every function, you'll see user notes. So you can read what other people have tried to the thing. And if you have a contribution, if you find a bug, that's one place where you can say, hey, the manual's not quite right. Basically, documentation bugs are covered there, but also sometimes functions. But if it's a real programming bug, you should file it in the bugs database. Few shortcuts, searching, Alt-S, you can search very quickly on the site. And there's also a show source link at the bottom of every page if you want to see how we built the actual PHPNet website. And we have mirrors all over the place. We have two, I think, Australian mirrors. Are the mirror guys in here, just by chance? No? Okay. au.php.net and au2.php.net, I think, are both active mirrors in Australia. All right. So we're getting back down to the bits and pieces here and getting going. PHP server side. Hopefully you figured that out by now, but it runs on the server. It's part of the web server for the most part. You can also run it separate from the web server. But what happens is that you have a file on your server in your directory new document root typically, that has HTML tags and then this embedded tag. In this case, it just says echo hello world. This tag is going to get evaluated by PHP and replaced with its result. The result of an echo hello world is going to be hello world. So the result of this thing is going to be that. So when you do a view source in your browser, this is what you will see. You will not see the PHP embedded in it. This confuses some people. Some people see JavaScript and PHP in the same file, and they do a view source in their browser. They see the JavaScript, but they don't see the PHP, because JavaScript is client-side, PHP is server-side, right? So the PHP tags get replaced first. I know that's very basic, but this is introductory, so we'll build up. Don't worry, I'll lose everyone by the end of this. So. 4 different ways of embedding tags in PHP. The short tag style, this was the initial tag style I came up with. I read the HTML spec. There was something called a PI tag or a process instruction tag. I go, well, that's sort of what I'm doing. I'm processing instructions inside HTML files, basically. So that's the tag I picked. I didn't read the spec very well, because it also actually said that you should specify what type of process instruction you're doing. So I should have put like this, bracket question mark PHP. This is a PHP instruction. But back in 1994, nobody else was doing PI tags inside HTML, so I didn't clash with anything, right? This was my tag. Then XML came along, and XHTML, and they suddenly started using my tag. I'm like, whoa, wait, guys, you can't use my tag, it's mine. But they didn't listen to me. So if you are mixing XML and PHP in the same file, which you actually really do, generally you will have your XML separate, and you will parse the XML with PHP, but there are certain cases, and more people are using XHTML, where you usually put a little XML identifier at the top of the thing that uses question mark bracket, bracket question mark XML, and then the XML version stuff. Personally, I like to just echo that string out so I can still use the short tags, but you can turn off the short tags, and then every PHP tag you put in, you have to put question mark PHP. You can also use ASP style tags. They're turned off by default, but there's a configuration file called php.ini. In there, you can turn on ASP tags. There's a directive called ASP tags. You can say ASP tags equals on, and you can turn those on. Generally, it's for front page and other editing tools that prefer scripting inside front page tags. Or if you're converting an ASP script over to PHP, it's a little bit easier. It's a little bit less typing if you don't have to convert all your tags over. But these days, most editor tools understand PHP just as well as they understand ASP, so there's really not a whole lot of use for that. The first version of Dreamweaver wanted all scripting inside script tags, so we added a script slash script type thing. It's really too verbose to use for anything. In these slides, you will see my code in gray boxes and the output from the code in yellow boxes. This presentation is in a browser, you'll see. It's just Mozilla, actually, running in full screen mode. And all these scripts are running live, and the output you see is exactly what you see in the gray box, what it spits out when it runs through the PHP parser. So in this case, you can see we get out short tags, long tags. ASP tags are turned off, so that came out directly. I cheated a little bit. I wouldn't normally see this because it would be hidden. I would have to do a view source to see it, so I did escape or translate these things to LT and GT. But other than that, this is the straight output from there. All right, some basics on PHP itself. This is sort of what PHP looks like. Variables and expressions, use $foo equals something, $bar equals a string here, XYZ equals a double. Incrementing foo equals foo plus one. We have support for arrays. Two-dimensional arrays, three-dimensional, whatever dimensionals you want, you just keep adding on. Function calls, it's a very procedural language. We have object-oriented stuff, I'll cover that, but it started out as a very procedural language. So call a function returns something. Control structures, while loops, and various output functions, echo, printf, things like that. A basic characteristic of PHP is that you can switch in and out of PHP mode without losing your logical state. So in this case, I'm going through and I'm checking the user agent string. User agent is something provided by the web browser that says, this is the type of browser I am. So I'm checking using the string function call. Does this string contain that string? So I'm looking for MSIE inside the user agent. So basically checking to see if this is Microsoft Internet Explorer. I jump out of PHP mode by ending the tag, and I'm straight HTML now. So I can put whatever HTML I want using Internet Explorer, pop back in PHP mode, flip the condition with an else, and back out of PHP mode, you're not using Internet Explorer, and you can see the output. I'm obviously not using Internet Explorer, so that's the output. But that's a very basic part of PHP, is that you jump out, and you're encouraged to jump out of PHP whenever you have a big block of HTML. Go out of PHP mode and just have your HTML directly. Don't echo out 50 lines of HTML. End the PHP mode and have just raw HTML. So the whole point, yes. Question is the performance penalty with mode switching? No. It's really bloody fast. There's no big context switch there. It's fast to go out. If it's just a single line of HTML, yeah, it's probably a little bit cleaner not to jump out, but if you go beyond one line, I mean two lines maybe, but three or more lines, you should definitely pop out of HTML. It depends a little bit on how many variables and things that you need to inject into that HTML as well. But if it's raw HTML with no variables in it, jump out of PHP mode. Yes? Yeah, no, the question is the performance by not jumping out, is the performance penalty? No. I mean, neither one is significantly faster than the other. It's sort of the same thing. The bigger problem with leaving everything in echoes is that you have to escape quotes and stuff. There's something called HereDoc that you should probably be using. Probably a little bit ahead of myself here, but we'll do a little HereDoc one. It's a nice spot. I don't know. It's all TrueType stuff, so it's... I can check. Sorry. A little bit off topic. Monospace 18. But it's TrueType anti-alias. It's probably what you're seeing. And it's the anti-aliasing that makes it look really, really nice. It's a little slower, but it's cool. All right. So the HereDoc stuff, what you can do, you can say, bloop, 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 bloop. Oh, that's bad color set. Back. No, I know. That didn't help, did it? Thank you very much, VI. What the heck? Okay, let's see. I used to go to white because it's easier on an overhead projector, but let's go to black. Did I mess up? White and black, that's what I meant to do. Can we see that? All right. All right, so here's how to do HereDoc, and here inside here you can then do whatever, and you can put variables as well without escaping anything, and you can put quotes and, quotes and whatever, and it's not until you get to the end. So that's probably, if you don't want to jump out of PHP mode, but you have lines and lines of HTML with various variables in here, right, you can do it that way. Okay, form handling, another basic characteristic of PHP. We started off talking about a very simple form problem where you ask the user for their name and their age. So here I have a little form. The only dynamic part in here is this PHP self. PHP self is a magical PHP variable that's always the current script name. My problem I had with this before was that people would copy and paste directly from my presentation and save it as something, and I didn't really specify a file name, so they would save it as something and try it, and it wouldn't work, because this script was designed to sort of post back to itself. So unless they got the right file name that I had here, they wouldn't realize that. But this way, you can save it as whatever file name you want. It'll always post back to itself. So in this case, we have a name field and an age field. If I type it in, run it, submit it, hello. And in the receiving part of the script, I just have that. Hi, Ecuador name, you are Ecuador age years old. It does not take a computer science degree to figure out that a field named name will generate a variable called $name, and a field named age will generate a variable called $age. So it's quite straightforward. It's easy to do. It really is easy to do. Putting up a form on your web server that collects information and perhaps sends an email. Every time someone fills out the form, sends an email with the information. There's a mail function in PHP. Mail. Subject, to body, I think is the order of the arguments. And that's it. In three lines of code, you have now written a little form where you can actually take orders, for example, for things, and you have an e-commerce site in three lines of PHP. Try doing that in ASP. There's no mail function in ASP. You have to get a DLL, you have to get a COM object that you can buy for $34.95 from this little company that sells them, or you can sit down and figure out how to write your own mail object as a COM object. It just sucks. It really does. Try doing the same thing in Java. If you know Java, it's not a big deal. Writing a Java program that will take input from a form and then send off an email with that information, but don't ask me to do it in front of your eyes here. I mean, I know Java pretty well. I'm not a great Java developer, and it would probably take me a good day to sit down and figure out and do that. I can write this literally in three lines of PHP. I mean, it's here in front of your face, but I could also add a mail function, mail, and we're done. Question? Yeah, okay. The question is, if this is all in one HTML file, I have cheated a little bit just sort of for brevity here. There is actually an if dollar name around this block here, so that's why you didn't see it the first time through. So I'm only printing this if there was something in the name variable. Now, there is one little twist. Oops, I jumped ahead one. This is very easy to teach and very easy to show people, but there is a slight problem with allowing people to inject all variables directly into the global symbol table of PHP. So what we have done is we have made this configurable, and it's something called register globals. If register globals is on, these variables will appear automatically right in your global symbol table. If you turn register globals off, and it's now off by default, then you have to specify where you want the information from. So we, instead of putting it in the global symbol table, we just populate various arrays. All the post data, data that comes from a post method form, you know in your form you have a little method up here? If you have a post method form, the data from that form will end up in the $_post_array. So the array index is the name of the variable from the post array that you're interested in. So in this case, you might rewrite this script as echo $_post_name and post age to get the information. There's also get and cookie and server and various other arrays that take information from the different places that variables can come from. There's also one called request, which is a merge of get, post, and cookie. So that all the stuff that can come across from the user in a request, if you don't care where it comes from, you can pick it out of the request variable. Some basic data types in PHP. Numbers can be specified as normal decimal numbers, as octal. If you leave the number off with zero, it's an octal number, base 8. This has confused a lot of people. They don't realize that if they write 077, 077 is actually 511 in decimal. Right. I don't know how many times I've tried to explain octal to somebody. It's difficult when you target a scripting language at non-programmers. Things that seem very, very obvious, even to me who hate programming, it's not obvious to everybody out there. And stuff like numbers in different base systems is not obvious to people. Shifting bits around is not obvious to people. I'm trying to explain I'm passing stuff by reference. We'll get to that later. It's also not obvious. But anyway, hexadecimal 0x, the number. Floating point numbers, obviously. And here you can see the output of that. Hopefully none of these surprise you that 0777 is actually not 777 decimal. Strings can be specified in two ways, either single-quoted or double-quoted. Single-quoted strings will not do any expansion of variables or escape sequences. So in this case, $last will be literal in the string. If you put something inside a double quote, then variables and escape sequences like \n, \t, \r, they will all get expanded to the real meaning. So here's why you don't see $name here, you actually see $name expanded into the Rasmus $last here. Booleans, not much to say about those. A boolean can either be true or false, and there are keywords in PHP, both true and false. One thing that's important to realize is that variables are case sensitive, function calls are not. that bothers a few people out there. And I know a lot of people are sort of confused by that, but I did it because originally I wanted things to show up within HTML alongside their HTML tags. And people back in 94, sort of half the people would go all uppercase HTML tags, and the other half would go all lowercase, and others would sort of switch back and forth. So the first letter of the tag was uppercase and the rest weren't. So they weren't used to case in HTML tags. They really were not used to having big A and small a be different things, because it's not in HTML. It's the same thing. And these PHP tags were in there alongside HTML tags. For all intents and purposes, they were exactly like an HTML tag. So that's why, because people were not used to it, I didn't want to force people into now thinking about case-sensitive HTML tags. That's why, and back then we only had function calls in PHP. So the function calls were not case-sensitive, and it was just very hard to change. We have looked at it a few times, but well, if we change it, we're going to break everything out there. So we didn't. And honestly, if you have two functions that only differ in case, you have a problem. Right? It's bloody hard to read your code if you have to sit and worry about case on these things and go, well, get user with a capital G is very different than get user with a lowercase g. That's very bad code. So all the people who've been sort of harassing me to fix that, I think, well, guys, this is, you cannot give me a good technical argument why you need case sensitivity on function names. So it hasn't changed, and it's not likely to change. There are patches out there. There are a few people that have gotten upset enough at this that they have patched up the parser, and you can download a patch if you really do want functions that only differ in case. Anyway, because we are a loosely typed language, or untyped, almost some would call, we do actually keep types internally, but because we're dynamically typed, we have to do some dynamic conversion, or conversion on the fly of things. So if you do something like this, 5 plus the string 1.5 plus 10e2, you end up with a sensible output. So we look at the fact that you're using a mathematical operator, and then we convert the arguments to their mathematical equivalents and do the appropriate math. If I'd use a string concatenation operator here, we would convert things to strings, and you would see it as a big string. Question? How sensitive is it to spaces? It's not sensitive at all. You can put this on different lines, like most languages. Yes, well, inside the strings, now in this case, because we're converting over to numbers, it wouldn't really matter if you had spaces there. Between the pluses and stuff, you can put as much space as you want. Yeah, well, there's no equals there. But. Oh, okay. No, you can put 1,000 spaces around there. It doesn't matter. It's not Python. Yeah, it's not Python. Space. White space has absolutely no meaning in PHP. All right, arrays. All arrays in PHP are basically hashes. Oh, one more question, sir. How do I represent money? I tend to represent them as integers. Multiply them by the 100, and then when I actually do display them, divide by 100, there's a number format function in PHP where you can go in and specify what your comma separator should be for your 1,000 separator, basically. I mean, in Europe, it's a period. In the US, it's a comma. The number format function can take that and apply the right formatting to it. Or there's also locally sensitive display functions that can show money in the current locality format, things like that. But generally, sort of mathematically, I work in cents, basically. It's easier. Then you don't have floating point roundup errors and stuff, because you will hit that. Yeah. Okay, question is, what's the largest integer? We are 32-bit on the normal longs. If you need to work with really large numbers, we have two extensions. Yeah, I'm not sure what the number is, but we basically have a sort of a arbitrary precision package, or two of them in PHP, where you work with numbers as strings, and you can multiply a 500,000-digit number by another 500,000-digit number, and assuming you have enough memory to handle all these huge strings, it'll do the right thing. Okay? I'm drawing a blank on what the heck the name of these extensions are. One's called BC, but the other one is GMP. That's the other one. Those are the two functions. So php.net/bc or php.net/gmp, and you can have a look at those. All right, what are we talking about? We're talking about arrays. So all arrays in PHP are hashes. We have something called non-indexed arrays. Basically, that just means it's an array push. Pick the next available index. In this case, A2 will be 1.57. Or you can use strings as your array index. It really doesn't matter. There's really no difference between a string and an integer. In this case, if I put a string 0 and the integer 0 is actually the same element. So we don't make a differentiation there. Manipulating arrays, we have all kinds of sorting functions and traversal functions and some other stuff that can slice and dice arrays. There are lots of fun if you're doing a lot of array work. Questions? No. Some common operators. I mean, this is like most other languages you run into. Plus, minus, multiplication, division, modulus, logical OR, and NOT. You also have the words AND, OR, XOR. The word AND is a lower precedent version of the logical AND here. They're both logical ANDs, but they have a difference in precedence, where AND is lowest on the precedence level. It's a little bit hard to give an example of when you want a really low precedence one, but sometimes you have a long expression, and then at the end you just have OR die, for example. You want the OR to be very low precedence in that case. A little bit beyond the scope of where we're at right now in the talk. Some bitwise operators, AND, OR, XOR, shift left, shift right, string concatenation operators, dot, dot equals, assignments, comparison. You'll see this double equals, this is your normal, you're used to saying if A equals something else, you do A double equals something else. But we also have a triple equals in PHP. The triple equals in PHP checks both value and type. So the double equals, if you have a string that contains just zero and you have an integer that sets a zero, call A, well, do I have an example? Oh, I don't have one. But $A equals zero as a string, $B equals zero as an integer. A equals equals B will be true. A equals 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 B will be false because the types are different. Okay? And same thing with not equals. So there's a not equals equals, which is the opposite of equals equals equals. I guess it's a little bit confusing, but we hit that a lot. We didn't want to make the double equals case or type sensitive because on the web, everything comes across as a string. You have no way of knowing. There's no type in an HTML form, right? There's nothing the browser sends that, hey, this is a number, this is a string. You have no idea. I mean, an address comes across as some numbers plus a street name and stuff like that. I mean, everything comes across as a string. So you have a lot of strings, but within your application, you probably work with a lot of integers, and often, well, basically all the time, you're comparing things of different types. And it's only occasionally that you care about the type, but sometimes you do. So we made an easy way of also checking the type. Some examples of bit shifting. Probably don't have to go through that in great detail, but some various expressions here are the outputs of them. You can read through the PDF on your own for that. A user-defined function, this is the syntax, the function keyword, the name of the function, the arguments or parameters for the function. You do something inside the function, in this case we send off a query, and here's how we call the function, log data with the two parameters. The one trick here is this second parameter has an ampersand in front, that means this is a pass by reference parameter. Pass by reference means that we're passing in a reference to this variable, meaning sort of we pass the variable itself. If I were to change $data inside this function, that change would be reflected everywhere. In this case, I'm passing in PHP auth user as $user. If I change $user inside, since I've only passed in a copy, if I change it inside my function, that change would be local to the function. $user would not change outside. $data in this case would. Yes. The ampersand there specifies this function takes the second parameter by reference. So when you pass something in, it will be passed in by reference. There are no reference types, no. Default values. So if in your function declaration you say you give a value for one of your parameters, title equals default title in this case, that makes this parameter optional. So I can just call head by itself, head bracket bracket, and since I don't pass anything in, dollar title will be set to default title. If I did pass an argument, obviously dollar title will be set to that argument I pass in. And you'll also notice that I can jump out of PHP mode in the middle of my function call. So you can have functions that just have straight HTML. Start your function out of PHP mode, put all your HTML, pop back into PHP mode just to end your function. People do that quite a bit for headers and footers and things for pages. Some looping constructs, while loops, really nothing that interesting about a while loop, but that's what it looks like in PHP. We have do while loops as well, just like C or C++. We have for loops. I mean, a lot of this stuff, when I sat down to figure out what should a for loop look like, well, all I really knew was C, a bit of Pascal as well. So I went, well, a for loop is a for loop. You have variable initialization, you have your condition, and you have your incrementer. So that's how it works in PHP. You can put commas as well and have multiple expressions for each stage, just like in C. We have break and continue, just like C, basically. So in this case, if you don't know what break and continue do inside loops, in this case we're looping basically from 0 to 9. Once we hit 5, we say continue. Continue means skip the rest of the logic and go to the next iteration of the loop. So you'll see in the output that there's no 5 because the echo is down here and I have my continue that said, hey, skip to the next iteration right here. So at this point, we skip to the next iteration so you don't get the 5. At 8, we say break. Break means end the loop at this point. So that's why you see it stopping after 7. Yes?
I'm curious,
there's no
like 4 each iteration or...
There is. We haven't quite gotten to it yet, but there is. The one tricky part about continue and break that is a little bit different in PHP is that you can add a level or the number of nesting levels you want to escape out of. So if I had a nested loop, which is what I have next here, I have one loop inside another, I can say break two. That means break out two levels of the loop at this point. It would just do a break two, basically. There's no point in doing sort of a break beyond the number of loops you have. If you had 4 levels deep and did a break 3, then you'd only go up 3 levels. But if you put a number that's too big, you don't get an error or anything. It just... No. And I don't have for each on this one, but we'll hit for eaches, lots of them later on. Object-oriented programming. It's a bit scary, but I've done a few talks at universities lately. And I did one talk in Tennessee, of all places, to a freshman class, so first-year computer science students in Tennessee. And there were people in there that had never heard of procedural programming. And so leading up to some of this stuff, I showed them a function call, and I had the question, well, we see this method call, but what class is it in? Like, there is no class. It's a procedural call. And like, procedural, what's that? And then I had to explain procedural programming to them. There's a lot of kids coming out these days that are so object-oriented that they can't even imagine not doing things object-oriented. I have to struggle. I have to struggle to understand object-oriented stuff. I mean, I can do it, and I've written stuff, but it does not come natural to me. I think the next breed of programmers is just going to be completely different because they are so in tune with object orientation. I'm not sure if it's good or bad. I learned to program in C by disassembling my C code, basically. So I would write little snippets of C, and I would look at the assembly it produced, and that's sort of how I figured it out. That's not that strange. Am I that old? I'm sure. I'm sure other people, they're just afraid to say, but I'm sure other people in here have done exactly the same thing. But, I mean, I used to count cycles. Right? I mean, you write your C code, you can picture the assembly, and say, okay, I know this is going to take this many cycles. This other way of writing will take this many cycles, so we go this way. Right? Not always the cleanest, but you know it's the fastest. I'd like to ask some Java programmers, hey, how many cycles does that loop take? Right? They have absolutely no idea, because they go through so many layers and stuff inside a virtual machine and virtual machine learning and different architectures. They have absolutely no idea how their code translates down to machine language on their system, which I think is a huge loss. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I had 18 cycles to work with, right? And then I'm done. So, but anyway, yeah. Yeah, okay. I am smart ass. All right, so here's an object-oriented interface to PHP. You can declare classes. Here's your class definition for a class called cart. Has a property called items. Has a method called addItem. That takes two arguments. And we have this magical keyword called $this. This always refers to the current object. So we can also inherit, so we can have a child class called nameCart that extends cart, and we add a property called owner, and we add a function or a method called nameCart. If a method is the same name as the class within which it's defined, we take it to be the constructor for that class. This will change a little bit in PHP 5. We will have a way of specifically saying constructor. It will be $_constructor, but in PHP 4 and 3 as well, to get a constructor, you have to name it the same thing as the class. Now to instantiate it, cart equals new name cart. Penguin gear is what we're passing in. So we're passing in penguin gear for name here, which means the owner property on instantiation is going to get set to penguin gear, right? And we also call add item, which is in the parent class, because we extended name cart from cart. We also have access to the parent class methods, in this case add item. Now, it's not full Java-like object orientation. We're pretty close. And PHP file will add sort of the missing little bits. We have a lot of Java freaks out there that are really upset that we have skipped some of the things in Java. And they think that's the one true way to object orientation. I'm not quite sure who decided that Java was sort of the standard, but we're getting closer. We're sort of caving a little bit. Yeah. No, if you want from outside the class, you mean if you want to look at the variables? No, it's only if you want from... Yeah. Yes, within the methods themselves, if you want to refer to a property within your own object, yes. If you don't, if you just put $owner here, that's a function local variable that's only scoped within this method. Okay, if you want to drop out and use the properties in your class, then you have to use $this. One thing that's different about PHP is that variables are locally scoped inside functions. Even if there's a global variable with the same name, unless you specify that the variable should be global, it won't be. And I have a slide later on that, and we'll go through and the reasoning for that. A lot of people are upset at me for that as well, but I have a good excuse. It is a very good thing. You can do static method calls. So for functions or for methods inside classes that don't rely on any particular properties of that class, you can call the method directly using the double colon syntax. So in this case, we have a class definition. We never instantiate the class, but we call the bar method inside. And you can see it says bar called. And calling methods in your parent class, we have a bit of a thing. We don't really have a good way of getting the parent class. So we have to sort of cheat, and we have a function. So for the really object-oriented types in here, yeah, you can do a get parent class on $this. That will get you the name of your parent class. And it's mostly if you want to chain your constructors. Because when we have a child class, you instantiate the child class, both the child and the parent have a constructor, we will only call the instantiated constructor. We're not going to sort of jump up the chain. If you're extending many levels, we only call the level that you called in at. Sometimes people expect the entire chain of constructors up the line to get called. You will have to sort of hack that yourself in your constructor, where you can go in and say, okay, figure out where the name of my parent class, that's going to be the name of the constructor, and then we do have this parent magical keyword, so you can do a static method call to parent and then the name of that class, which is going to be the constructor, and that way you can do your own chaining of constructors. So in this case, you can see that it actually did work when I did that. Probably a little bit ahead of an introduction to PHP as well. That's usually the question I got, so I always stuck a slide in just to answer it. Some more pedestrian stuff, time and date. We have a date function that takes a format string. We also have a string at time function, more like the libc stuff that you might be used to. It's not the right time. This is the time in California, I guess. My laptop is back there. Here's a little program that figures out how old Carl is. And who's Carl? That's Carl. Yeah. 45 weeks, 6 days, 5 hours, and 40 minutes old. Just a little example of how to do sort of time and date math. Everything happens in Unix timestamps, number of seconds since January 1, 1970. So we have this make time function. Call make time with a date. So, he was born at 1:26 in the afternoon on March 6, 2002. So I get the Unix timestamp for that particular day. Figure out the number of weeks, days, hours, minutes, right? And I just print it out.
Is Carl's
name Yes, it is. And the R is lowercase because his middle name is Alexander. And if you capitalize the R on the end of Alexander, then it's nicely recursive. My wife wouldn't let me give him a second middle name starting with R. Would have been nice. But his name is Carl Alexander Leerdorf. Right? So it's almost recursive. But the CAL, he was born in California. So. We also have some other calendar conversion functions in PHP. Julian, Gregorian, Mayan. I have a question in France. If we supported the French Revolutionary calendar. And we do. We have full support for the French Revolutionary calendar. That calendar was only active for, I think, 18 years, or was it 28 years? I forget now. I think it's 18 years, from like 1796 to 18-something. So it's a very, very short-lived calendar, but we do have full support for that calendar as well. Yes? Make date, make time, you mean? No, make time, this is the order of operations on make time. There is string f time as well that you can play with, and there's a string to time function as well, which is kind of cool. String to time, you can just sort of, you can pass in like last Sunday. String to time last Sunday, it'll give back the timestamp of last Sunday. So if you, and that way you can also put in dates in different orders and stuff. But yeah, I know, the order of this one is, no, it doesn't, you're right. And I am honestly not American. It's just sort of, it fell out. This was the way I did it, and sorry. Yeah, I don't want to change the world. That's the whole point. All right, string manipulation. Another pet peeve of mine is that in Perl, everything is a regular expression. It's impressive how fast they are in Perl. They've done a really good job. But, man, it's annoying. In PHP, we have a lot of straight functions like substring. So in this case, if I'm going to pick out the first 4 letters of this string fast, concatenate the last 9 letters, epilation, right? So I get a new word called fast epilation, whatever that means. We have an explode function. Explode can blow up strings. It blows up strings into arrays based on the delimiter. So you end up with an array in $A that contains 4 elements. In this case, this string has delimiters. I loop through. And just sort of to show string comp, we have a string comp function that forces comparison by strings. I could have just used if $value equals equals has as well. Would have done the same thing. If I hit has, I change it to had. You can see the output. This string had delimiters. This list each is sort of an old syntax of going through an array. There's a for each as well, which we'll see in a little bit. That's more modern. Some of my slides are getting a little bit dated. Regular expressions, as much as they annoy me, we also need them. We have two types of regular expressions in PHP, POSIX style and Perl style. POSIX style are all the EREG functions. And you also notice that everything in PHP is a function call. I absolutely hate magic. I hate $_:// :// :// :// If you don't know Perl very well, what do you look up in your book, in your index? right? Tilde equals. There's nothing there to go on. There's actually no hint as to what this bit of line noise does. So that was one of the things early on in PHP. No line noise, no magical operators that you have actually no way of knowing what they do. Everything is a function call. And even if you don't have a clue what this regular expression does, at least you can go to the manual and look up EREC replace and see, okay, this is a regular expression. And POSIX-style regular expressions tend to be a nicer and more verbose in the sense that you can actually read what's going on in them. We also have Perl-style regular expressions, PREG are the functions. There's a family of functions that do various things, PREG match, PREG replace, stuff like that. And you pass in a regular expression, you pass the replacement string in this case, and the string to be acted on. Other more web-specific stuff, we have HTML special chars, which will go through a string and change all the HTML special characters into their equivalents for printing out on a web page. If you want to show this and that are problems written like this, you have to change the ampersand to ampersand AMP semicolon, and you have to change the less than sign to ampersand LT semicolon to have it actually show up correctly. So that's just what this function does for you. Base64 encoding, this is just to show that it actually does work, right? We go back and forth through 64 encoding. And we have all kinds of other functions, MD5, DEST, triple DEST, Blowfish, and a bunch I don't know what are, RC6 idea. All kinds of functions for doing encryption and encoding of strings and numbers. Reading a file, very simple. There's a read file function. Here I'm reading my proc CPU info. It's a special Linux file that gives you information about your CPU. So if you're on a web page, it just prints out your CPU info file very, very easily. I'll put pre-format tags around it, just so I don't have to worry about tossing in BR tags or anything everywhere. So read file, proc CPU info, and there we have it. And see, it's a Pentium 3 700, old laptop. We never had a function that took the contents of a file and put it into a variable. We had a function called file that would take the contents of a file and put it in an array, one element, or one line per element. But now in PHP 4.3, we finally have one that just takes the entire file and sucks it in. It's a little bit embarrassing. A lot of people would take this through $A equals file, the name of a file, and then they would do an implode to get all the elements into a single variable of the array. And that was kind of embarrassing that they had to go through that second step. So we finally fixed that. So that's just the same output by going through a variable. Well, in this case, you can see I don't have the pre-tags out in front. So here I'm actually putting everything, the whole file, into a variable. I am trimming off all the carriage returns. Trim contents. Yeah. And then I'm changing, because I had carriage returns and new lines in the thing. Then I'm converting all new lines to break tags. So that's why I have a break or a new line after every line here. C-like file functions. If you know C, fopen, feof, fgets, so open up a file, loop through until you hit the end of the file, print out or read a line and print it out. All the various file functions take URLs, either HTTP, FTP, or HTTPS now as a 4.3. That's pretty cool. You can both read and write to these things. To write to an HTTP URL, you would have to have moddav or something. We haven't quite got that worked out yet. Mostly you read from remote files. You can read to an FTP URL. You have to put the username and the password in, or, I mean, if it's wide open to the world to write to the FTP directory, you can just do it. But in standard URL style, you would put username, colon, password on the FTP URL, and then you can write remotely to an FTP server as well, or append. All right, here's a little bit on scope. I always get asked, if I include files, how do I pass variables into my included files? People ask me, well, do I put question mark, foo equals one or something on the end of the file name, just like a URL? No. Included files share the same global scope as the rest of PHP. So you set the variable and you include the file. Inside file.php, you will have access to $foo. Included files do not have their own scope. Inside functions, you have a function local scope. So you have function bar, in this case, global foo, echo dollar foo. That's how you access the global dollar foo. So here you can see we echo out one, because in the function I have specified, hey, the $foo I'm going to be using in this function call is the global variable version of foo. This is sort of upside down from the rest of the world. The rest of the world says, well, if we have a global variable named foo and you use it inside the function, well, then it's the global variable. I really don't like that. And I got so burned by this at one project in Canada. I worked on a company called Bell Northern Research. They were the research arm of Northern Telecom. And I was working on this huge telephone switch that would randomly drop all calls every now and then for no reason whatsoever. And there was this big ACD system running on it, automatic call distribution. You know, when you call into an airline or something, you get put in a queue and you sit there waiting until it's your turn. So this was a big switch that would manage all that stuff. But every now and then, this switch would drop everybody. All the current calls and all the people sitting waiting in queues, everyone would just get dropped. And the customers were quite upset at this. And I was hired in as a co-op student. It was my first year, and I went to the University of Waterloo in Canada, and we have this co-op program where we go out every term and work somewhere. And that was my first job. And it was sort of a sucker job because nobody there had been able to find this damn bug. They've been going for months. And, you know, let's find a co-op, and that's the only task people have for 4 months is to find this one bug. And that was my job. I came in there, they gave me the code, which was a stack of the old dot matrix printout, the wired style with the perforations down the side and stuff. A stack of this about this big. And I had no idea what the code did, but it said, find this bug. And I attacked it. I mean, as a young student, right? Like, okay, that's my job. Let's attack this. And I took over a hallway, and I posted this stuff on the walls, and I had it on the floor. I had big signs for the cleaners, stay away, don't come down this hallway and stuff. And I was there with a magic marker and a laptop going through pieces of code, testing it and marking off, okay, check that. And I did finally find it 3 weeks in or so after debugging for solid 3 weeks, 12 hours a day, I found this problem. It was an error logging function somewhere that was clobbering a global variable that a completely different part of the code had set, hadn't marked it static or anything. The debugging tools at the time, this was in the 80s, were not up to snuff to find these things. And that I just nearly died when I found that. I was like, oh, God damn it, right? And then we started a new thing that said there's a rule that if you use a global variable inside the function, you have to put a big, big comment that says, this function touches these global variables. And when I came to do PHP, I figured, well, why make it just sort of a policy comment? Why not make it part of the language? If you're going to touch global variables in the function, specify which global variables you're going to touch. So that's what you do. And I've gotten a lot of hate mail from this. People say, well, I have 37 global variables. Does that mean I have to specify 37 global variables right here if I want to access them all? Yeah. Or, I mean, perhaps you should not have 37 global variables? Just a guess. There is another shortcut in there. There's something called, there's the globals array. All capitals, dollar, globals, and caps, we can specify an index foo, and that would get you access to the global variable as well. But the point here is that it should be very obvious if you're accessing a global variable. And all caps, globals, is a very obvious thing as well. You can very easily skim a function and see which global variables it uses. So I have absolutely no regrets. I mean, I would do it again. Right? Well, yeah, my point was, hey, I'm done, right? Give me my pay for 4 months, and I'll go get another job or something, but no, they put me to work on other stuff, unfortunately. static variables, I mentioned for recursion, you really need a static variable type, so the variable only gets initialized the first call to the function. So in this case, you can see static.i equals 0, I call bar 2 twice, so I get 1 and 2. This is a pre-increment operator, which means increment the variable, then do the rest. So we increment, then we return, in this case. Questions so far? What time is it? So it is 11:30. Should we take a 5-minute break, maybe? I have lots of stuff to cover, so let's not linger too long, maybe. Come back at 11:30, perhaps? 10 minutes? And we've trim the audience down a bit, that's probably good. I couldn't take 6 hours of me either, that's for sure. All right, I'm going to skim a little bit fast. We need to get to some more interesting stuff. But we talked about register globals and the various arrays that are available when you turn on register globals. These are the different places that stuff goes. I already went through a couple. Get, post, cookie, request. Those are the four we've mentioned so far. Just to sort of summarize, get are variables that you see right in the URL. Those are get method variables. Post method variables come through post forms. Cookies come through cookies, normal cookies. Server variables are things set by your web server. These are the types of things that your web server might tell you about, document route, various HTTP things, the path, remote address, all the various things that whatever web server you're on exports to you. In this case, it's Apache, and these are the variables that it has exported. And also, there's an ENV variable that has all the environment variables. So whatever was in your environment when you started your web server, you're supposed to use a very clean environment for your web server. In my case, I haven't. It's just my laptop. There's a files, and there's an HTTP raw post data. Files contains stuff about uploaded files, RFC 1867 file uploads.
Whoa.
HTTP raw post data. This will get filled in if we get a post that we don't understand in a strange encoding type. Some PDAs, some phones that try to do web stuff will send really, really odd requests to web servers. If you're writing some kind of app that relies on talking to some of these devices that don't send real requests, you can sort of escape out of all the PHP processing of the data and just look at the data yourself. So look at the raw post data yourself if you need to. Database abstraction. Database abstraction to me is quite useless. For a long time, PHP had no database abstraction, mostly because SQL is not SQL. Every SQL is different. So if you rely completely on database abstraction, then you basically have to just go by the lowest common denominator of SQL that you have across all the databases you want to support, and you end up with a crap application. The way I do database abstraction is I write code for each particular database. Basically, I have a get user record or get user function that works for Oracle, for MySQL, for Postgres, for DB files, whatever. And that's how I do my abstraction. Most people sort of get very upset and argumentative when I tell them that database abstraction is useless. And it is useful to some extent for very simple applications. And you can sort of use it on the second layer, so you don't have to learn each of the APIs. So within your get user function for the different databases, you could use the abstraction layer at that point so that they all look the same. But the SQL that you send is going to be different across all the databases. Your schemas are going to be different. In Oracle, there's a decode function, for example. Decode in Oracle is extremely useful. You can do some really, really funky things with decode that you can't do in any other database out there. And you have to go through all kinds of hoops in other databases to emulate decode, basically. But you're going to have to go through that to do it. Or you can just ignore all the database-specific things and write vanilla SQL, and your application will just be crap everywhere, but it will work everywhere. So that's why I'm not a big fan of database abstraction. Having said that, here's how we do database abstraction in PHP. We have a database abstraction class. We pass in this URL-like thing that has the database type, colon, the username, the password, the host it's running on, and the table or the database you're connecting to. Prepare, execute, fetch, disconnect. Very simple. There are a couple of different database abstraction libraries out there. This is sort of the default one that you get with PHP that comes with it. Any questions about database abstraction? Anybody want to argue with me? No? Good. HTTP headers. There's a header function in PHP where you can send any type of HTTP response header back to the client. The most typical one people send back is the location, which does a redirect. So you can redirect people directly. Another thing people send often is a last modified header. By default, dynamic content served up by Apache will not have a last modified header on it because it's the data that you're generating that you're interested in. You can't just look at the last modified or the timestamp of the actual script file, because that script file can connect to databases, and that database data can change. You should send the last modified with your data, but you have to figure out what your page last modified date depends on. Which data does it depend on? And if you have a way of determining that this was last modified at this particular date, then you can send the correct last modified, which is a very handy thing to send. And also sometimes you want to sort of defeat all caching out there. You can send various headers that say, don't cache me ever, never, no cache expires, blah, blah, blah. Question? Yes. The question is the way to tell it's only cached for a certain amount of time. Yes, that's what the expires header is for. So you set an expires header that sets the date and time that you want this data to be expired from caches. And caches may or may not understand that, but that's sort of what it's supposed to be for. Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of people don't understand caching. More people should. I'll talk a little bit more about it later. Cookies, this is sort of a special case of the header function. You can set a cookie directly using just header and do a set cookie with all the right parameters, but we have a helper function called set cookie. Pass in the name of the cookie and the value for that cookie, and it'll do it for you. This will set a session cookie. A session cookie is known as, it's a cookie that doesn't get written to the client's hard drive. It's only valid for the current browsing session, so when they close their browser, it goes away. Persistent cookies are cookies that have an expiry that will then get written to the person's cookies.txt file. That's how you send that. You send a Unix timestamp of when you want the cookie to expire. Reading a cookie back, if register globals is on, you can just echo out the cookie name, automatically gets in the symbol table. If register globals is off, you get it out of, this is sort of the old name for the underscore cookie variable. It used to be HTTP cookie vars. This is still valid. Or you can just say underscore cookie, cookie name, and that'll work. Deleting a cookie, you just set the cookie with the same parameters, except a blank string, basically. Then you're being nice and friendly and telling the remote site, hey, you can delete this cookie now. Very few sites seem to delete cookies. They're all setting them. They never delete them. And you can pass in other parameters, the path, the domain, secure. Read the Netscape cookie spec if you're really interested in the various things, or the documentation in the PHP NetSite website. All right, a quick example of PHP actually doing something, not very useful, but doing something. A little guest book. It used to be really cool to have a guest book on your site where you can do things. Type in a note and it would show up. Next person would come in, type another note and it would show up, and people had little conversations in the guest book. Sorry? I don't know why it underlines. It's some kind of weird Mozilla bug. I've looked through my HTML to figure out, well, hey, why the heck is it underlining it when I go into this form? I don't know. There's nothing that I saw in there. Some weird bug. Ignore it. So, here's the code. There's a little form that goes through and says text area named note. And that's really all the only interesting thing in the form. There's a submit button as well, or send it button. And then I check to see if the note variable is set. If the note variable is set, I open up a text file in append mode. So every line that I write into my text area is going to get end up appended to this notes.txt file. So fputs with a br tag at the end of it. And then to read it back, I simply do a read file on notes.txt. Right? So every time through, if I've typed something, I hit send it. If there's something there, it gets written to the text file. Then at the end of the script, I just simply read that text file back in. A very, very simple little system that does the job. Now, there's a few tricks here. There's a little at sign here. At sign swallows up errors. And the reason I have this in there, I know the first time I go to my guest book, notes.txt won't exist yet because the file hasn't been created. So I swallow up the error message in that case and ignore it. Anybody know the history of the at sign where I stole that from? Because none of this stuff is unique to PHP. DOS, exactly. Remember autoexec.bat files years and years ago? You would put at signs in front to swallow up output? That's sort of where I stole the concept from. This doesn't swallow up all output, only error output. Though, so not quite the same, but almost. But yes, that's where I got the idea from. So another little tricky thing here is, what if five people hit my guest book at the same time? Is my data going to end up all jumbled in my file? There's really no reason it shouldn't, right? There's no locking going on. I'm not locking the file, writing to it. It's So am I screwed in case five people hit it at the same time? Why not? But why would it do it all in one go? If five hits come in at exactly the same time, I have five different Apache processes all running, they're all going to be writing. You're right, but you don't know why you're right. What? Am I not opening it? Which? I think you're on the right track. I'm opening up in append mode. Append on most operating systems is atomic as long as you're appending less than a block size. So on Linux, if you're appending less than, I guess, less than 8K, right? Block size, depending on your file system, 4K sometimes, 8K other times. So unless you're writing really huge nodes, and even so, it's only going to be like 8K, then someone else's 8K, then the second part of your 8K, right? I mean, block size appends are atomic, so you don't have to worry about locking on an append. But still, dealing with text files and the web is really a bad idea. In this case, it works because we're sort of lucky that we can append atomically. If we wanted to write it in reverse order, for example, so we wanted our most recent notes first, and we had to rewrite the file every time, we'd have to lock it. And once you start locking, you've lost. So the same thing I used to say about XML. Once you go to XML, you've lost. But I've sort of changed my mind a little bit on that now. So this is sort of where we start going into the SQL stuff. PHP is used a lot with databases. A typical PHP script would look something like this. Connect to the database, select the database to work with, send off a query. If there was some result from the query, put some HTML candy around the results. So this is 90% of the PHP scripts out there look something like this. We support a lot of different databases, so the native APIs of all these databases, plus a few more. I haven't updated the slide in a while. And also ODBC. But let's go back to our guestbook. So here's our guestbook, which appends to a text file. To turn this into an SQL-driven guestbook, it's extremely easy. And a lot of people say, well, I want to keep things simple, so I'm just going to use text files. I'm not going to worry about using a database. Using text files is extremely complex because of the locking problem. Yes, we happen to get lucky that we can append atomically. Most people in here didn't know why this actually works, so they're just sort of, they would have done this, and hey, they lucked out, it worked. If they changed their append to a write, suddenly their application would break, and most people wouldn't know why. They say, hey, why is my application not working sometimes? I test it every now and then, it works fine, but every now and then, all my data is corrupted, and that's because, well, probably two people hit the application at the same time, and everything got screwed up. So, to convert this little database, or this little guestbook into a database-driven one, we create a database. In my case, I'm using MySQL. You can use Postgres, whatever you want. MySQL is a very, very simple database, so it's easy to teach. MySQL admin, create MyDB, creates a new database. I create a very simple schema. The schema has three columns. For those of you who don't know databases, think of a database sort of as a spreadsheet, maybe, where you have columns and you have rows. Across the columns, you have the different types of information, and then each row is sort of one set of data. So in this case, we have an ID, a comment field, and a timestamp. So I'm giving it, every entry in my guestbook, I'm giving an ID. The comment field has the actual text that the person entered, and then I also have a timestamp that says, okay, this was the time that this entry was entered. So not only are we changing it to a database, but we're also adding a lot more features to our guestbook very easily. So here's my schema, and I made the ID my primary key. This is my index. This is what I'm going to look up entries by. When you tell a database to use something as an index, that means that the database will optimize queries so that things specified by that particular column will come out much faster. And that's a really bad explanation of indices and databases, but I'm not here to teach you about databases. So instead of opening up a text file and appending to it, we now connect to a database, select the database to work with. So my database is running on my laptop here, localhost. I created my database called MyDB, so MySQL select DB, MyDB. If the note was set, and here I create my own timestamp. I say, in this format, Y, month, day, hour, minute, second. You can also have MySQL create the timestamp for you. It's actually pretty easy. It's probably easier just to have MySQL do it. But in this case, I created it. Insert into comments values, zero note CS. The first thing is was the ID. You notice that I'm just passing in zero every time. All my elements won't have zero. There was something in the schema that I didn't explain. It's this thing called auto-increment. That basically tells MySQL, auto-increment this particular field. So every time I insert a new row, it's going to get an incremented value. I can just pass in zero, which specifies, hey, you figure it out. So I don't have to sit and try to figure out what the next valid ID will be, which would also be something that I'd have to lock for to figure out, because I'd have to read the current one, make sure everything was locked and then incremented. That would be a bad thing. So this way I can just say, hey, MySQL, pick the next logical ID. So now I've inserted my stuff. To read it back, instead of doing a read file, I send off a query, select star from comments, and then I wrap a little bit of stuff around it, just spaces in between my different rows, so row 0, 1, and 2. MySQL fetch row will get you an array, which each entry in an array element. So the first one in 0, second one in 1, third one in 2. There's also one called a MySQL fetch array, where you can have named things. So you can have row ID, row comments, row timestamp as the element here. But this is the sort of the simplest approach to it. So if we do the same thing, I type something in, send it, you'll see that we now have an ID, 1, the comment, and the timestamp. Type something else in, they'll get 2, the comment and the timestamp. Now, this is not significantly more complex than the text file-based one. We get so many things out of this. If you wanted, for example, to put newest first, all you have to do is change the script to order by ID or order by timestamp descending. Right? Very easy to do. In fact, why don't we go do it, actually? That's 2, is it in here, I think? Yeah. So, in our actual select, we can go order by, what was the name of it? Was it TS? Descending. Oops. We go back, we redisplay this particular slide. We redisplay this particular slide. Now you see we have the most recent first. I put another one in, it's going to go on top. Now, to do that in the file-based one is hard. Because either you have to write the file in reverse order, so you have to rewrite it every time and lock it, which is a bad idea, so you wouldn't do that. What basically you would do is read the entire file into memory and then print it out in reverse order. But say then you said, well, I want it in reverse order, but I only want entries from today, for example. That would be really hard with a file-based one because you have no timestamps. Then you have to rotate the files and stuff. It gets to be a huge mess. In this, you can go in and say, well, I want timestamps in reverse order only from last Friday. And it's very easy just by changing your query. You get so many things from going through a database that you really should just start off with a database. Take the extra 5 minutes to learn how to set up, even just a simple database, and it'll save you a whole bunch of time later on. Because whoever has asked you to build something, they'll always come back later and say, oh yeah, but could you also just please make it do this and just make it do that. And if you start down one path with a file where it works for the initial set of requirements, but as soon as they go a little bit further, you're probably going to be out of luck. You're probably going to have to change at some point anyway. Question? Yes. Did you come in late? I covered it about 20 minutes ago. But yes, there's a database abstraction layer in PHP. Yes? If I put a double, let's go check. Yes, and we'll talk about that in, actually, we'll try it here. I'll just so you know that it works. This is a quote, like that. And it magically worked, right? But you obviously know a little bit about databases and say, hey, that shouldn't have worked because I have no code in here that escapes the quote before I put it in. There is generic code in PHP that will do that for you. So let's get into the MySQL stuff a little bit. To actually set up PHP to work with MySQL, like with most other databases, you have to enable the extension within PHP. PHP has extensions that talks to all kinds of third-party stuff. MySQL is one we're sort of tightly coupled with. We included MySQL extension with PHP. If you install PHP on Linux on your favorite distribution, be it Red Hat, Debian, whatever, there is a separate package called PHP-MySQL. So if you are on, well, first you can check, you might already have MySQL support. You can check by putting in a PHP info script. So on your server, once you've installed PHP and Apache on your server, if you put a very simple script that just has this function called PHP info inside PHP tags, and you load it up, so go to localhost info.php, for example, you will see a page of all kinds of information. Inside that page, there will be a block that says MySQL, and will have various information about that MySQL extension. If you don't see any mention of MySQL, then you don't have that extension enabled in your PHP setup. What you can then do is, if you're on Debian, for example, apt-get install php-mysql, on Red Hat, rpm-uvh, php-mysql, or you can grab the source code and compile it directly. You can go in, grab the PHP 4 source code, and just call configure --- with MySQL equals shared, and here comma user, if you already have the MySQL client libraries. You need to have the MySQL client libraries on your machine to compile it from source. And in that case, if you do it that way, you will have a MySQL.so. This afternoon, I'm going to show you how to build your own extension, your own shared library that you can plug into PHP and talk to third-party stuff. That gets pretty hairy, by the way. So. and you enable it by, in your PHP ini file, you say extension equals MySQL.so. Typically, RPM and the apt installer will not enable it for you. So you might install it, but it may not be enabled. So you go into your PHP ini file and you say extension equals MySQL.so, and you restart your web server, and you should now have MySQL support. Yes? It will ask you if you want to, okay. Oh, it's PHP 4? Okay, sorry. It'll find it with php.mysql as well, won't it? There's an alias or something. Yeah, right. So it will sort of get you there. Yeah. Sorry. They're just saying that the real package name under Debian is actually php4-mysql. This will get you there because it'll go up and show you if you want php3 mysql or php4, so you'd pick php4. And the second thing they said was the Debian installer does actually enable it, or it'll ask you if you want to enable it in your PHP ini file. I like to sort of just make sure that people understand it, so you don't have to trust the installers. You can go and figure out what should have been done and just check that it has been done, so it'll work. So, assuming now that you have PHP set up with MySQL support, you can sanity check your install, obviously, make sure MySQL is running, type MySQL show on the command line, make sure it's running. You can also, within PHP, call MySQL stat. MySQL stat is a little function that returns things about the server, the uptime, number of threads running, number of queries, slow queries, things like that. So that's a good little sanity check to make sure that PHP and MySQL are communicating with each other. A typical problem you might have is actually that your Unix domain socket is not in the same place, but PHP and MySQL are not agreeing on where that socket should be. In your connect call, you can specify it. You can also change it in, there's a my.conf file, there's a configuration file for MySQL where you can change where that socket is supposed to be. We've had some problems with the bundled version of the MySQL client library not matching the location that the server installed version of the client library has. So if you run into a problem where it says can't connect to MySQL because it can't find socket mysql.soc, that's going to be a problem. You can either fix it by changing where that thing lives, read the MySQL docs, or specify right in your PHP MySQL connect function, colon, the path to that socket, and that'll work. Other things you can do with the latest version of PHP and MySQL, you can also have SSL encrypted connections to it and compressed connections. So if your web server might be outside the firewall, and want to connect across the web somewhere, or internally, you can go encrypted from outside the firewall inside to talk to your MySQL server, which is pretty neat. Next slide. So I've shown you just a normal MySQL connect. There's also something called MySQL pconnect, which does a persistent connection to the MySQL server. A persistent connection is a connection that does not go away at the end of the request. It's not a connection pool or anything. It's simply a connection that gets established between the Apache server instance that happened to take that request and the backend MySQL server. So sort of graphically, it looks like this. Eventually, if you have a server that does a pconnect from a PHP script to the backend server, eventually all your HTTPDs are going to end up with an established connection to the MySQL backend. This speeds things up a little bit because we can obviously skip the connect stage. So the next time through, if this same script gets run on the same Apache instance, then MySQL pconnect is just a no-op. You don't have to add in any logic or anything to check if it's already there. MySQL pconnect does that already. It just returns really, really quickly the second time because it's already there. You have to be careful with this a little bit. You have to watch out for your max connection setting in MySQL and your max client settings in Apache. Max client in Apache is the max number of Apache child processes that you can have. Max connections is the maximum number of connections that MySQL can support. By default, max connections in MySQL is 100. By default, max clients in Apache is 150. That means that by default, you can open up 150 Apache processes that all want a connection. And sort of the symptom of this problem is that one-third of all your connections will have MySQL errors on them. And people will call you and say, hey, it doesn't work. I'm getting can't connect too many connections. And you try it. Hey, it's fine. Because you happen to get one of the ones that has a connection, and he got one that didn't have a connection. So just make sure these things are in line. Either increase max connections or decrease max clients. And try to set max connections to max clients plus one. I had mine set one time to the same thing, 100 and 100, so I had 100 active connections, and then I tried to come in via the command line tools, just MySQL admin, to restart my server, for example, no more connections. All right, so I had to kill off an Apache process and be really fast to get in there before it would respawn. So I could just look at stuff. So set max connections to max client plus one if you're doing this. And be careful that multi-credential connections, basically this remembers the username and password and port and host and everything that you connected with. And if you come in and you make a pconnect with some other credentials, it's going to open up a second connection if it's to a second database and stuff. So be careful with this. You may want to just use a normal connect. Pconnect is not that useful for MySQL, to be honest. MySQL is very fast at opening up connection. If you're using Oracle, you need a persistent connection because starting new Oracle connections takes a long, long time compared to MySQL anyway. All right. So creating a database. Normally, you wouldn't really use PHP to do it, but you can. You can call a MySQL query. Assuming your Apache user has the right permissions to create databases, you can just do create database foo, and you can even create your schemas directly from PHP. A MySQL query call in PHP can pass through any kinds of queries that you want. So this is sort of a useless thing to do, but yeah. Yeah, there's a tool called PHP MyAdmin that's very, very popular. It's a web front end to administer MySQL written in PHP, and it's very, very popular. I've never personally used it. I really like command line stuff. It took me a long time to start using X. I wasn't really I'm serious. I mean, I had my QNX boxes, my first Linux boxes, Alt F1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? I had all my shell terminals. That's all I needed. Maybe screen every now and then. I don't need these graphical stuff. So the web changed that a little bit. Using links got kind of painful after a while. All right. So inserting data. Here I have a little example of having created a database, the schema I created on the last slide. Now I insert. I have a function called add user. I'm inserting stuff into it. Insert into users, values, an ID, encrypt my password. So this is using MySQL's built-in encryption functions, so I store encrypted passwords, name, email, null, I forget what my last field was. Let's go look. Timestamp, okay. The timestamp field, the last one, the guestbook had a date time type. The other way around, timestamp, well, I guess it's not the other way around, but the one called timestamp is a field that MySQL will automatically update. Whenever you change a row, it'll update that timestamp field for you automatically. So that's why I'm just passing in a null. So here I'm creating this little database that just has a bunch of names, and email addresses. I'm putting in two users here, add user, last name, password, my email address, my kid's email address, and I get that row inserted each time, right? Because I'm checking. So see here, I reloaded this page, right? And it goes through and says duplicate entry, Rasmus for key number one. So I tried to do my insert once again, and it goes through and says, hey, wait a second, you can't. You already have that one in there already. That's because my schema included a primary key, so you can only have one of these. All right. Selecting the data back out, connect to the database, select the database again, select star from users, just like we've seen, and I get the data back out of my database. We talked a little bit about fetch array. With fetch array, you can now specify, instead of just numerical indices, you can specify the column names. It's a little bit more portable. In case you go back and you change your schema, you insert another column, you don't have to change your code. You can just go by the names. It doesn't matter what order things are in. Let's see, what else can I do to this data? Date format, I get asked this a lot. People get the MySQL format coming back out, the date time format that comes out of MySQL by default, and they say, well, we need PHP functions to manipulate this stuff. MySQL has all kinds of functions built in that can format things, and they have this generic thing, date format, where you pass in the exact format that you want the date back out of. So in this case, I'm just calling date format, and I get my date back out in a different way. Yeah? We don't have a real try-catch type mechanism in PHP 4. We have one in PHP 5. Basically, you have to do direct error checking on these calls yourself. There's a MySQL error message you can see here, right? If I got an error back from my query, I call this MySQL error function that then prints out the error message. It's pretty crude, but I mean, that's sort of straight, simple error checking that you can do. There's no try-catch mechanism in PHP. You have to wait for PHP 5 for that. All right, my browser is slowing down. I'm using the latest alpha release of Mozilla 1.3, and I think there's a memory leak because it slowly slows down. I might have to restart it soon. Updating a row. You can do an update query. You can also use replace into query. A little bit beyond the scope, I guess. I just wanted to give you an idea of how to go about connecting to a database, inserting stuff, getting stuff back out, updating stuff, and then the question you asked about quotes. There are various characters that you cannot just insert literally into a database because within the SQL command language, those quotes mean something. So if the user enters a quote or tries to be tricky and puts a quote and then another SQL command or something to try to hack your system needs to be aware of that. By default, PHP has something called Magic Quotes GPC. In your PHP INI file, you will see this turned on. And what this means is that any data coming across get, post, or cookie data, so any data coming from the user will automatically have special characters escaped. That's single quote, backslash, and double quote, and also the null character. Those four characters will get escaped appropriately based on which database you're using. And that happens automatically. That also means that if you were to echo out that information containing a quote, you will see that backslash in it. And you should call strip slashes on it before you echo it to the screen. It's sort of, depending on what you're doing most, if you're doing most inserts into the database and just displaying a few things every now and then, or if you only display after reading back from the database, have PHP do it for you. If you display a lot of things, and then every now and then insert to the database, you may want to turn off magic quotes and do your own add slashes call before you insert data into the database. Yes? Sorry, you completely lost me with your Australian accent up there. Slow down, please. No, because it happens before your script gets executed, right? So you have to do it at the PHP INI file or at the Apache configuration file. Basically, the question was, can you at script time turn off magic quotes. And no, because this, we read the information from the user, then we execute the script. By the time we execute the script, we've already read and escaped the data. So you have to do it beforehand, either in your PHP INI file or in your Apache configuration file, where you can also change PHP INI directives. All right, we're on time. We can finish this, no problem. This is the more interesting part, I think. At least it's more visually interesting. There's really no difference between the rest, but here's a cool bit. You don't have to use PHP just to generate HTML output. You can use PHP to generate any sort of output. So let's do a linux.conf.au in Perth message. Right? This image that you see here, very, very slow. No, I think I will kill and restart this. Thank you. I also fried the stick of RAM, so I'm down to 128 megs in this machine. So, it should be nice and quick now. Not super quick, is it? What's it doing? Was it still trying to get to Yahoo? Maybe. Come. Yeah, no, I did tell it to stop. I'm not sure what the heck it's doing now. Maybe I shouldn't have. Is it because my interface is still up? Let's make sure my interfaces are both down so it knows not to go there. Come on. What happened? Okay, maybe bad idea that I shut it down. Okay, can't get to Yahoo. Great. I don't want to get to Yahoo. Yahoo is far away. Okay, now it's fast. I don't know what I did there. My problem was I'm doing a PDF talk, Mozilla 1.2, with the Acrobat PDF reader crashes after you leave a page with an embedded PDF in it. In 1.3, they fixed it, but 1.3 is a little shaky in other areas, so it's a little tricky. We were playing with images finally here. Okay, now we're fast. Look at that. So this was the linux.conf.au. This is an image that's not, it's obviously not a static image. It's an image that I'm creating on the fly. It's not stored on disk anywhere. The only thing that I have in this particular page is I have this tag. It says image source equals text.php. So if, you know how the web works, where you, when you make a request to a page and you get something back that has both images and text in it, it's actually multiple requests. You can only have one data type or one MIME type going across every request. So you get one request goes in and requests the straight HTML. Inside that HTML, you have image source tags. Whenever the browser sees an image source tag, it will make a new request to the server saying, okay, I need the source or I need the image data for this particular image, and then it puts it there. So what? Yeah, whatever. It's never going to change. They're always going to have image tags. So, image source equals, it hits this tag, it says, makes a new request to the browser for text.php, and in here we pass in the text that I typed into this form. So I'm making a request to the server, ask for text.php, my text.php script is this. In text.php, the first thing I have to do is change the correct MIME type. So content type image PNG is what I'm going to send. If you send anything except text HTML, you have to tell the remote end, here comes image PNG, or here comes whatever format that you want to send. By default, PHP sets it to text HTML. So first thing we do, image create 630 by 80, 630 pixels by 80 pixels, allocate a couple of colors. The first color you allocate, so that by default, in a paletted image, is going to be a background color, so you don't have to fill in your background color. In this case, it's a blue in RGB format here in hex. Then I also allocate a white and a black. And then I use the imageTTF text function. Image true type font text, it stands for, in my image, at font size 45 points, at orientation 0, 0 being horizontal, 90 would be vertical, 45 would be on an angle, at XY 1057, so at 1057, start drawing in black in this candy font. There's some generic true type font I downloaded from somewhere called candy.ttf, and then the text I want to draw. So first I draw in black, then I go up and to the left a little bit at 654, and I draw in white, exactly the same thing. And then finally, image PNG. That streams out the PNG data stream. That's it. That generates this image. Right? There's nothing else to it. Yes? Then, well, we can't do it. On the next slide, I can show you what happens about cropping and stuff. Or on a couple of slides, actually. Color handling. The library we use for this stuff is called GD. GD initially was done just to do GIF images, so they were limited to 8-bit colors, which means 256 colors. So if you go through and you say, I want all the shades of red, green, and blue, all 256 shades, you're going to run out after 256 shades of red. There are some functions in the library that are useful, like image color closest. So if you have a limited palette of 256 colors and you want to draw something in green, chances are there's a greenish color in there somewhere. So you can pass in and say, image color closest, give me the closest green that's already in the palette. Or you can ask for an exact, or you can also deallocate certain colors. And it's kind of cool to play with the palette of images and change the color for various palettes, because then you can sort of make all the pixels of a certain color by just swapping the palette entry for that particular color, you can change the color of that thing. And there's a very nice application written, a kid's application written that's colored in a monkey, where you can point somewhere in the image and it would then change the palette entry for that particular color, and so the entire monkey's stomach would get filled in with a certain color. Instead of trying to do a flood fill, you can do it that way, and you can just specify various parts of the image to have different color indices. That was kind of a neat use. But beyond that, I have no use for a palette of images. Basically, everything I do these days is true color images. So do image create true color? Question? Yes. There's an optional second argument to the image PNG call. That's the file name. And I'll show you a very good use for that in a little bit. So with true color images, you don't have that problem. You don't run out of shades. You can do as many as you want, basically. Yes?
How come image PNG can't set the header for you?
Because it doesn't. Because there's no reason to. I mean, you do things. Why would it set the header? Maybe you only want to save this stuff to a file. Maybe you have no intention of sending it over the web. There would be no point in sending out a content type header at that point. Sort of the Unix approach to things. Small tools that do small things. Same with the PHP functions. They have very specific goals, and you put them together. So for true color images, the actual color at every pixel in a true color image is stored in this 31-bit long. It's not 32 because the very highest bit turns on and off anti-aliasing. The remaining 7 bits in the high byte set the alpha channel, or the transparency of that particular pixel if you're in alpha channel mode. So just to give you an idea of what this alpha channel means, here's an image I created, 400 by 300. So I start with an image. In a true color image, I have to fill in my background. So I start off by filling in image rectangle in white. You can see in RGB here, FFFFFF. So I fill in a white background. I create a black ellipse. You see color 0000 is black, so I create this black circle. Now, on top of that, I put 3 red rectangles. I use the same red color in all 3. FF1111 is my RGB for that particular rectangle. The only thing I'm changing is my alpha channel. So you can see a high alpha channel, close to the top, which would be 7F, because it's a 7-bit alpha channel. A very high alpha channel is very see-through. 7F, you wouldn't be able to see the red at all, basically. Slightly lower, it's less see-through, and very low, it's almost not see-through at all. If I set it to 0, you wouldn't be able to see the black circle through it at all. So that's what an alpha channel is. And this same example could also be written by using this image color resolve alpha. This is kind of a holdover from the old style where you had a palette of images, where you had to allocate colors out of the palette. You had a limited set of palette entries. the true color really doesn't make any sense at all, because all this function does, it takes these numbers that you pass in, it's RGB alpha channel, and just puts them together for you. It gives you back the equivalent of 0x60FF1111. Give me a break. You can just put that number directly. So that's what I generally tend to do. I just specify my number directly. I'm smart enough to know that this is the format of the actual number, and it's much faster doing it that way. Another way to write it, just sort of to show you bit shifting, right? You can set the lower byte shift left to set the middle byte of the RGB to set the green, shift left 2 bytes to set the R. And that gives you the same kind of thing. But you can see it's very easy to create little images. It doesn't take a lot of code here. And you can do some very, very cool things with it. Here's one cool, very useless thing that you can do with it. You can start off with an image. So in this case, what I've done is I've said image create from JPEG. My JPEG is this little tiny PHP logo, right? And I can then get the size, the height, and the width, and I loop through pixel by pixel, and there's something called image color at. Image color at returns you the color value for that particular pixel. Then you can also do this image colors for index. That gives you back a little array, RGB, with the actual RGB values. Then I've taken that and put it into a normal HTML font color tag, right? So I've created a text version of the image, and this is just straight. I mean, I can highlight. This is just straight characters. I put a hash mark, and I put the right font color that I read out of my little JPEG image and put it up. I think that's pretty cool. And you can make, if you had a really, really big screen, if you had a really big screen, you could do a full graphical browser that was text-oriented, right? And if you sat at the back of the room, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Okay, so your question earlier on clipping. So here's a little one. This is sort of the original reason I wrote this stuff, was the project I worked on at the University of Toronto. I had the person, we had basically a graphics person that was assigned to us, and she also covered many other departments. Any sort of graphical needs had to go through her. I was building a website for the university, and there were various sections on it, and each section had a graphical button, so you clicked on this graphical button to get to that section. I could create a new section for the website in about 3 hours. I had to submit in writing with a little sketch to this person in her inbox, say, I would like a button that looks like this, please. And then I wait a week, sometimes 2 weeks, and I get this email back saying, okay, here you go, here's your graphic. And then I could finally make my site live, or that person on my site live. And that was just such a hassle, right? So I took one of her images. I could do enough graphical work to get rid of the text in it. I asked her, which font did you use? She said, this is the font. Sent me the TrueType font file. And I just pasted that TrueType font file on top of it. And I could then generate these images myself on the fly even. So here's a version of the PHP logo generated on the fly. I didn't bother writing code that would do the oval and everything, so I start off with a blank logo. So image create from PNG, PHP blank.png. One trick here is this function, image TTF bbox, image true type font bounding box. That passes in the size of the font, the orientation, so horizontal is 0, the name of the font, and the actual text. And it gives me back an array that gives me the rectangular coordinates within which this text would fit. So I know how wide it is, I know how tall it is. That lets me center the text within the button. So I do a little bit of math, divide the width by 2. The height, I can't just divide by 2. I have a little fuzz factor because different fonts have different size descenders and ascenders in it, and there's really no good way. The TrueType font files really should be specifying the size of these things, but they don't all, most of them don't do it correctly. So you sort of have to play with your font a little bit and figure out sort of vertical spacing. So then I do the same thing as before. No real difference. The white outline, I tried doing with a slightly larger white font and a smaller black font, but the spacing was all messed up. So instead, I draw 4 times in white. So up and to the left, up and to the right, down and to the right, down and to the left, 4 times in white, and then smack in the middle at x+1, y+1, I draw in black. Then I have this white outline. And we can do a linux.conf.au button. The default font's a little small, I think. Oh, it's a little big. Never mind. So that's what happens when you go beyond the edges of it. It just gets clipped. If we go, say, 25, I think that might fit. So there we go. Now we have a linux.conf.au button, right?
Mm-hmm.
The question is, for the really big font, would it return the correct numbers? Yes, it would come back and return the right numbers. So you could do some code in there that would actually shrink the font size and make it fit. Yeah, sure. I mean, you can, but since I start with initial image size, I can't really, well, I could scale it, but yeah, you can add all kinds of code. You know that if you're going to go beyond the size. Yeah, you could, sure. Sure. So another thing you can do, you can take images, you can scale them. Here's another image of Carl in a strawberry hat. This was taken with my old digital camera that was 1536 by 1024 is what it spits out, and it's stored on disk at that size, but I'm showing it to you here at 900 by 600. So this little script here took the image off the drive, scaled it down using this image copy resampled function. Image copy resampled is a function that goes through, and so the samples and averages off. So if you're going 2:1 in height and width, you're going to have 4 pixels that turn into 1. What image copy resample does, instead of skipping pixels, it takes those 4 pixels, averages them, and writes the average to the file. Other scaling functions out there might just skip every other pixel, and the quality goes way down. The only other interesting thing is I put up little rectangles that have an alpha channel, as you can see, I think, yeah, that is sort of a see-through white box. So that's just me setting the alpha channel on those draws and then putting text on top of them. You probably wouldn't want to do too much thumbnailing. You wouldn't want to thumbnail a directory or 1,000 images. That would take a little while with these functions. But if you cache the output and you only do a couple at a time, then it's a handy way of scaling images. Text? Yes. There is no name because it doesn't have a name. If you're looking for it somewhere on the hard drive, the only place it could possibly be would be in the cache somewhere. It doesn't have a name of any kind. I mean, in my actual, you saw my slide earlier where the image source equals text.php, blah, 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 blah. If I go and say save this image, right, save image as, let's see what file name it picks. See, this says image underscore resize dot php dot png. So it doesn't really know what the heck to call it, so I just called it the name of the script that generated it and stuck a dot png on the end of it. There is something called a content disposition header, where in your actual header, and some browsers understand it, so up here, content type, you can also say content disposition file name equals. That says, when the user tries to save this image, here's the suggested file name for you. But it's not a file on my server. It's not there, right? The scaled down image is just generated in memory and spewed out. All right, so text in these things. The image library has built-in text. It has 5 fonts. These are the fonts. You can't change the sizes, so they're not extremely useful. They're quite ugly. The only thing that can change is if it's horizontal or vertical text. That's it. So if you're just doing some bar charts or something, you just need some simple fonts to put on labels and things, and you don't want the hassle of TrueType font files, it'll do, but it's not pretty. Most people use TrueType font stuff. It's not that hard to do. Here I've written a little script that goes through and opens up my user to share fonts TrueType directory and reads in all the font files that are there and puts them up in an image. You will notice that a few fonts didn't work. These two didn't work. You need to have the full Unicode mapping in the TrueType font file. Not all TTF files have the Unicode mapping put in there. If you don't, it just won't work. Pick another font. Most of them do have it. I did this slide originally for a talk in Paris, and I was just checking to see if the font had the accent aigu and the E on it. You can see some fonts do. This one doesn't. Just leaves off the character. Most of them do, though. A few don't. All right, EXIF, not completely related, but most digital cameras put in EXIF headers in your JPEGs. So here, for example, this is my original JPEG of the baby coming out of my digital camera. I do an EXIF read data on it and loop through, and it shows me various things like the file name, file date, time, size, height, width, the f-stop, and other things are down here somewhere, the codec, thing, the name of the camera that took the image, resolution. So here's some stuff about the aperture, whether flash was used, shutter speeds, all this stuff. Most cameras will put this right into the JPEG. And it's kind of a neat thing, especially if you're building an online photo album or something, that you can pull all this information out and put up a little info block about your photo. And there's also an embedded thumbnail in most images, which is also kind of neat. I discovered this sort of, I missed a flight in Copenhagen once, and I was stuck there with just my laptop and my digital camera, no internet connection, sitting in the airport waiting. Didn't know what to do. So I started playing with my camera and looking at it going, wow, it's really fast. I can go through and I can preview all these images. And I was writing some code that was doing image scaling. I was working on the image library. My laptop takes a long time to scale an image down to a thumbnail. How come my little camera can do it so fast? There's no way. The CPU in my little camera versus my laptop, there's no comparison. So the only explanation was that every time I take a picture, it must store it twice. It must store it big and small. So I mounted my CF card in my laptop, looked at it, and went, no, every time I take a picture, there's exactly one more file in my file system. That means that it must write twice inside the same file. So it must be a big image and a small image in one file. So I start looking through with OD and looking for the JPIF header and stuff. I didn't find it because it ended up that the thumbnail was actually a TIFF inside the thing. But I found all kinds of other information in there, like the Kodak string and other things. So, hey, there's other information in here. So I wrote this XTIFF thing to pull it out. Of course, once I got back and got connected to the net, everyone knows about XTIFF. I didn't know about it. And there were libraries to do it. I thought I'd been so smart and I had figured it out. So anyway, that's where that came from. And there's a XTIFF thumbnail function in PHP that will pull out the thumbnail. If the image has an embedded thumbnail, you can pull it out and you can display it. Yes? Currently, in 4.2, no. I don't remember if 4.3 has the code. I'll check. I don't think so yet. There is somebody working on it, but I don't think they finished in time for 4.3. It's currently read-only, I'm pretty sure. All right, getting away from images a little bit, and this I'll talk more about on Friday. I have a normal conference session on doing PDFs with PHP, but just to give you an idea, it's a little bit tedious writing a PDF from PHP. You can go through and say PDF new, PDF open. You have to set all the characteristics of your PDF, do a begin page with the size of the page. You can put images in it by doing open JPEG and then placing the image at a certain position. It gets annoying because the origin of the PDF is bottom left, so you're sort of working from bottom up. There are ways to flip that, which I'll show you on Friday as well. But basically, in the end, you can do something like that. You can have a script that generates an invoice, like that, for example. And the invoice data can come from an array. In this case, I'm passing it in. Or you can query a database. Very popular with e-commerce sites, online shopping cart places, where printing stuff from HTML is a real pain. You go somewhere and you have an invoice, and you print it, and you end up with two pages. Page two has the total, right? You have to then file two pages instead of one page. Here you can set the paper size. You can format everything exactly the way you want with the fonts that you want. And it's just a better way of doing sort of hard copy output of web page information. And with this, you can generate everything on the fly, everything about it. It's a little hard the first time to sort of generate your template. But then once you have your basic template, just filling it in is very easy after that. It's also interesting. This slide I wrote a couple of years ago, I've shown it many times to people. Three times now, I have bought something online where they had a PDF invoice, and at the very bottom of the PDF invoice, they had this color bug. I never fixed it because I sort of, it's a little indication that people are using my code directly. I mean, they changed the logo, they changed the addresses, they changed the layout a little bit, but I have this code in there that alternates the gray from white to a sort of a dark gray. But it doesn't do the very last one. And I've seen this three times now. And there's no way that they had the same bug that I had. So it's a nice way of... And there's no problem taking the code, but it's just fun. Another thing you can do on the fly from PHP, you can generate Flash directly. Spinning logos. It's what the web was for, right? Spinning logos. So, no, it doesn't blink and it's not flaming either. I did think about having a flaming spinning logo. Maybe next year. come to Canberra or Adelaide, wherever it's going to be next year, I'll have a flaming logo for you. So the way we actually do this, I mean, it's really no different from what we've been doing up to now. Instead, here we call these, it's a library called Ming. Ming is an object-oriented library. They have all these different objects that do different things. I know nothing about Flash, honestly. I know absolutely nothing about Flash. People tell me it makes sense. It didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I wanted just to spin a logo, right? So I figured, okay, let's load in my image, load in my JPEG. I figured out that there was a bitmap object. Great. The bitmap object takes a file pointer, so you open up your image, you get a file pointer, you pass the file pointer to your bitmap object, but there was no spinless method on the bitmap object. So I had to figure out, okay, fine, there's no way to spin it. What you ended up having to do, you had to get it to a sprite, and the sprite takes a shape, and the shape takes the bitmap. So you sort of have to put the bitmap inside the shape, put that inside the sprite, then you can call the rotate method on the sprite, and then you create frames, and you put all that stuff into a movie, and you play the movie, you set the rate of playing, you set the dimension of the movie, and you're done. But it is a little bit hard to figure out initially. There are some very good examples on the Ming website, opaque.net/Ming, if you're into this stuff, and if you know a little bit about Flash, they tell me that the objects that are sort of in the PHP API very much mimic the underlying objects of Flash. So if you know the Flash format a little bit, it's actually very easy. It's a very nice mapping for real Flash people. I don't have a lot of use for Flash myself, other than sort of the ooh-ah effect in presentations. Sorry? Yes. I'm getting towards that, though. Here's one. I'm combining XML, RSS, and Flash in this slide. So what I'm doing is I'm reading, I actually have a static copy of the /.rdf file. If you go to /.org//.rdf or something, you get the file, /.rdf. That is an RSS file. So this newsfeed format in XML, and there's an RSS class in PHP that you can just load in. So you can go through and you can say, XML RSS, the file, parse it, and you can get back an array that has all the items in it, and you can then count how many were there, for example. So by this point in the script, I've already gotten the entire XML file parsed. It's in memory. I have an array of all my items. Then I can create a little movie that goes through, uses a Flash font and various other things, and basically I get this effect at the bottom here. So all the /.headlines, so they're zooming out at me, and it's clickable, so if you click on one of these, if I had a network connection, I would be able to go directly to that story on /. It's a pretty cool little thing, right? So, I mean, it's not super useful. It's Flash. It's cool that you can do it from PHP, I think. Now, we've talked a lot about generating stuff, dynamic stuff from PHP, images, other things, Flash, PDF. My button example, where I have a website where every section of my website has a different graphical button. It's handy when I'm sitting there developing my website. It's not so handy if I'm getting hit 10,000 times a second. And on every single request, I have to go and generate this image. And I'm getting the same image every single time because my button text does not change. It's a little different if you're doing stock quotes or something where every request comes in, it's a different stock versus another stock, and you have to draw graphs and stuff. There you really have to generate this stuff dynamically. But even then, you can still cache things. One of my favorite ways of caching things is through Apache's 404 error document handler. So what I typically do, inside my images directory, say all my images come out of this home doc root images. In my Apache configuration file, I have an error document 404 images generate.php. That means that every time the browser comes in, says, I want this particular image, Apache goes, looks on the drive in my images directory, doesn't find it, it's about to send a 404 to the browser, say, 404, not found, go away. My error document 404 gets in the way there, says, wait a second, let me have a look at it first. So generate.php gets this request before the 404 error message is sent to the user. So I get the request. And in my program, I can look at the file name. I have an ugly regular expression here that basically just splits off and says, give me everything up to the first underscore, then basically picks out the parts between the underscores. So something underscore dot extension. And I get those four things out, the type of the image, the text, the RGB, and the extension. I get these out of the regular expression. You can do whatever you want with the file name. That's just what I decided on in this case. The color is my third argument, so I go through and I break it up and I figure out, okay, he wanted a black image, for example, in this case. Then I generate the image. I look at the extension that they asked for. If they ask for a JPEG, I'll generate a JPEG. If they ask for a PNG or a GIF, I'll generate a PNG. Until June 14, I'm not doing GIF, right? So the patent, the Unisys patent, expires this year, but not till June. Not that we need GIF anymore. We've replaced it nicely. We really don't need it. But I will be putting in GIF write support back into PHP in June. Right now, we have only GIF read support. I don't feel like getting sued. Okay, so we pick the type of image we're going to output. Then we look at the type. I have sort of two ways of specifying stuff. You can either have a solid square or a button. It's just an example. I generate an image just like we do before. In this case, I put some button text up with a highlight around it. And then I spit it out. And here's the whole trick. I send it out, I save it in the file, and I also send it out to that particular user. So the user who came in, asked for an image that wasn't there, it's going to generate the image, save it as that file that he asked for in that directory, and it's also going to spit it out to him. So the next person who asked for that exact same image, Apache is going to look in the images directory, find the image, and send it, right? That's it. It's been cached. If you want to flush your cache, you just delete all your files. Then the next request for that particular image is going to generate it. So the very first request for an image is going to take a little bit of time, but then subsequent requests are completely transparently going to be cached and sent out. Yes? It does. It does in the sense that people can then make up all kinds of different image names and they can get generated. But you can also, I mean, you can put whatever logic you want in here, right? And you can say, well, we only want this range of images, or we only want this certain thing. And frankly, very few people would know that, hey, this particular image source slash images button.gif, right? How would they know that, hey, they can actually put button 1, button 2, button 3, button 4, button 5, and fill your hard drive? And, I mean, my web server is running on a RAID 5 240 gig partition, right? It's going to take them a long, long, long time. It's more denial of service attack on them than on me, I think. All right, a little bit on pair. Sure. Well, when you call header, you have to call header before you send any output. By default, we don't cache the output. So yes, the header function has to happen before you send anything else out. So far in this script, I haven't sent anything yet. I've only been processing stuff, right? I'm only looking at data and manipulating stuff in memory. But before I send my image PNG here, this one, I have to make sure that I do the header beforehand. I can't do the header after. I'll get an error. But I'm manipulating it, right? The only thing I'm reading off the disk is the blank image. I'm doing this blank wood.png, then I'm layering my TTF text on top of it, right? So this thing says test, right? So I mean, the whole point is that I can put button, well, let me show you. It's probably easier. I'm not actually sure I have it set up right. But basically, here's the URL that's going to be in my image source tag. It's going to be images. button_test_0000.png, right? As I'm writing my web application, I can simply say, okay, now for this particular part of my site, I want a foo button. So right in my HTML, I say image source equals images slash button underscore foo underscore ff0000.png. I don't have to drop out to a graphical tool and generate my button. I know that the first time I hit my site, it's going to get generated for me, right? And that's the point. I mean, I'm reading only the blank button, the background for the button off the drive. Then I'm putting the text and the color that was asked for on top of the image. Then I write that. Because any file named this is always going to give me this particular button, unless I change the way my template is. If I don't want a wooden background anymore, right? I want something else as the background. Then I have to go through and delete all my buttons and have them get generated. Oh, okay, sorry. Yes, I could at this point save it to the file, then do a read file, but why? I already have it in memory, right? The image is in memory, so I do one, I write it to the disk, and then I send it out, right? There's no point writing to the disk and reading it back into memory when I already have it. Okay? Yes. What do you mean, why am I generating the PNG? Because I don't do PNG. I don't do GIF. I'm not allowed to generate GIFs. I'd get sued by Unisys.
But if the intention
is yes? Any sane browser is going to get back. Yes, I'm basically ignoring the fact that they're asking me for a GIF. I send back the right content type, and I send back a PNG. And yes, IE doesn't understand MIME types. It's not a browser. It doesn't work. But it doesn't. Seriously, IE does not work. It's not a real web browser because it doesn't understand MIME types. You send a MIME type that says text plain, and it'll still render HTML inside it. It'll still execute JavaScript inside it. I can crash your Windows box with a text file. File.txt that comes across as a file text MIME type, and I can crash your Windows box every time. That's nuts. It's really nuts. Anyway, don't get me started on... So, Pear is a PHP extension and application repository. It has a very app-like interface to it for installing new packages and doing things. It's designed to be a repository of decent PHP applications. There's a lot of really bad PHP code out there. It's sort of what's good about PHP and what's bad about PHP. PHP really appeals to people who don't have a lot of programming experience because it's so easy to get going. It also appeals to lots of people who are really good programmers, but the fact that there's a massive amount of people who have very little experience, which is perfect, it's great that they can write web apps. Sometimes it's not so great that they distribute these things to other people. I mean, sometimes they should just stick to solving their own problems, and that's perfect, but sort of convincing other people that this is the right code for it. So PHP has got a bit of a bad reputation for having some really, really bad stuff out there. And yeah, and other people blame me for saying, well, why do you make stuff that lets these people program? And that just annoys me so much. This is not some kind of elite, exclusive group that we're in that only certain of us are allowed to program. Everyone should be allowed to solve their damn problems. Right? And we build tools and we make it easy so everyone can do that. But this Pear thing is a way of taking solid, mature code that's very useful for other people. Like the database abstraction library, for example, is in Pear. We release some Pear packages with PHP. Others will only live in Pear. There's also a component of Pear called Pickle, hence the pickle up here. This is the extension library for C programs or C extensions. And I'm still reading through all that. You can do that on your own. So to show you what it can do, at your prompt type Pear list, for example, that will tell you the installed set of packages. Hopefully, some of the big things like Gallery, PHPBB, Nuke, and some of the other things out there, huge PHP apps, will package up their things in Pear format. A couple of them are already working on it, so that you can just do a Pear install Gallery, for example, and the whole thing will install very easily for you. It's a little bit of a hairy mess right now trying to install various PHP apps. You have to touch a bunch of files everywhere. The Pear installer is going to solve that. Another one, Pear Remote List, gives you a list of all the available packages on the Pear server. There's a lot more than that now. List upgrades, for example, they'll just list the available upgrades for things that you already have installed. So you can do Pear Upgrade DB or upgrade your database abstraction library. Pear Install for installing different things. So it's a very handy little thing. It's bundled with PHP 4.3. It's available for older versions of PHP, but really sort of 4.3 is when we went live with Pear, and we're seeing a lot of pickup on that stuff right now. I have 10 minutes left. I decided to move the security stuff to the afternoon session because I knew I'd run out of time. All right, let me slam through the session stuff. PHP sessions. Sessions are needed because HTTP is stateless. You do not have any way of connecting one request to the next request when a request comes into your web server. The only way you have of doing that is to hand the person something, saying, okay, Bob, you came to my website. The next time you come back, please give me this information back. So I give you something, give me this back. That's your session ID. That's the only way of tying requests together in the web application. A lot of people, when the whole cookies are evil thing hit, man, did it annoy me. I've been going to all the various meetings and stuff and saying, look, guys, we need the browsers to sort of let session cookies through. Don't let people turn off session cookies, because there's no reason to turn off cookies that don't get saved on their hard drive. Because without session cookies, doing any kind of session-oriented web app is really, really hard. You have to munge the URL, and URL munging is even more evil than cookies. So I always have this argument with people that say cookies are evil. No, they're not inherently evil. They're extremely useful. As a web application programmer, you really need the damn things. And it's not for tracking people. I don't care where you live, who you are. I just need to know that when you come in and put something in your shopping cart, next time you come back, I'm going to give you the right shopping cart, not somebody else's. Right? And I don't care who you are until you have to pay me for stuff. So it's not for tracking people. It's just sort of for making sure that we can maintain a session throughout a web session. So what happens is a browser comes in, makes a request, and you might have different web, you might have multiple web servers as well. So you have to take care of that in your architecture. We'll go through a little bit quicker here. So the way you do this in PHP, you assign a session ID by calling session start. Session start will first check to see if there already is a session ID. In this case, we'll say it's the first request coming into a site. There's no session ID already. Session start assigns the session ID to this particular session. Sends it as a cookie to the user. You can add things to this session. By adding things to the session, you mean you sort of tie data to the particular session. So in this case, you put it in this session array. $_session, name the variable, and give it the value that you want to maintain in within the session. Now on request number 2 to a separate page, session start, the session ID is there. So the user would have sent it either in the URL or in the as a cookie. Session start sees that and goes to the back end and says, hey, give me the information for this particular session. It comes back and then repopulates the session array. So on page 2, you can now do echo $_session myvar, and you will see hello world. Even though it was set on one page and displayed on another page, it got stored on the server. You typically don't want to send this stuff back and forth between the browser and the user and the server, right? So the only thing that goes back and forth is the session ID. All the data for the session is stored locally on the server. By default, this stuff is stored in temporary files, /temp/sess/blah. There's also a shared memory backend module for PHP. Not too many people use that. You can configure this in the PHP INI file. Session set save handler, by default set to files. That's for the flat file backend. If you set it to MM, you get the shared memory backend. You can set where you want these files saved, in /temp, for example. You can set the name of the session ID. What this really means is the name of the cookie that ends up going back and forth. Auto start will always start a session, so you don't have to call session start at the top of every page. If you know that every page is going to be part of the session system, you can turn on auto start with one caveat. If you're adding objects to your session, you can't use auto start because you have to load the class definition before you instantiate the session. So not too many people end up putting objects into their sessions, but the few who do, you have to turn off auto start and do your own session start. So include class definitions.inc session start, and off you go. Then you can put anything you want into your actual session file. So, and you can put entire arrays of things, objects of things. You can't really put file descriptors, open database connections, things like that. That doesn't translate very well, because a part of this is also so you can have multiple web servers running and have a central data store, which we'll look at next. So the central data store can be somewhere, and you can't really take an open database connection that's on one server and expect it to do anything intelligent with it on another server. Right? Those are sort of ties to the script, but any other type of information you can put in the session. A whole bunch of other things that you can set in there. Don't have time to talk too much about it. One interesting part is the actual caching of it. You can set the cache characteristics of your session. Generally, you want to keep it at no cache. Don't let anybody cache a session type of mine. Think of the shopping cart example. You don't want a half-empty shopping cart sitting in AOL's cache, for example. So one AOL user puts something in, the next AOL user puts more stuff in the same shopping cart, right? If that ended up getting cached at the AOL proxy level, that would be a bad idea. With HTTP 1.1, there is, however, a distinction between public and private caches. So we have a way of setting this to cache limiter equals private. With the cache limiter equals private mode, what we end up sending is a set cookie with a session ID, an expiry that's way in the past, that'll basically expire this stuff, but also this new HTTP 1.1 cache control header that says, hey, if you are a private cache and you understand this particular header, if you don't understand it, you end up not caching because you understand the expires header. That's the HTTP 1.0 way of caching stuff. In 1.1, you set cache control. You say, hey, if you're a private cache, you are allowed to cache this thing for 10,800 seconds. And if you're public, you can't cache at all. A private cache is like your end user cache. It's your client cache on your browser, so your own hard disk on your laptop, for example. And finally, you can also set it to public, which means even public caches like the AOL cache or the cache here at the university, for example, if you set it to public, they're allowed to cache it for whatever time you set. Generally, you don't do that. All right. So in case you have a server farm and you want a central data store, you can write what's called a session set save handler. That's a handle that's going to handle writing stuff to a backend, and you can write it to any backend you want. I wrote an SNMP-based one once that used SNMP gets and sets to put it in the memory of a Cisco router. Yeah, it's a little bit ugly, but I was trying to convince this one company that I needed a separate server, a separate database server. They wouldn't give it to me. I said, fine, I'm going to put this on a separate machine. The only separate machine I have is the damn router. That's where I'm going to put it. The router didn't have enough memory for this, so I was sort of stretching it, but there were some registers I could put stuff in on it, and after a while they finally said, okay, fine, damn it, stop messing with the router. Generally, it's a better idea to use a database, MySQL, Postgres, whatever. What you end up doing, you can set the session module name to user, which means it's a user-defined one, and you have to write 6 functions, and then you call this session set save handler with those 6 functions that you've written. These are straight PHP functions that look like this. You can ignore this stuff at the top. These are the 6 functions. Open, close, read, write, destroy, and GC, garbage collect. It looks a little bit complex, but it's not that bad. The open function opens up the back end, so connect to the MySQL server, select the database, for example. Closing the back end, MySQL close, not a big deal. Reading from it, you get an ID. And it's important to understand that the only responsibility of a session set save handler is to take an ID associated with a piece of data and pass that data back and forth. The read passes the data back, the write stores the data. You don't parse it, you don't do anything with it, you just get a big blob of data. It's encoded and stuff, but it's just a big long string. All you have to do is store it and retrieve it. So you read it back, select data from table where ID equals ID, pass it back, write to it, replace into table ID value, so the data is there, you associate the data with the ID in the database. Destroy it, easy, delete from table where ID equals ID. Garbage collect is probably the most complex one. This is the one where you go through, the garbage collect function will get called every now and then to get rid of old sessions. And here you have a max age, basically, for a session. So it goes through and it will delete any sessions older than the configured time. You configure that right in your PHP INI file, how long this will take. Now, simply require handler.php, assume this script up here was all in handler.php, load it in, and then everything is sort of transparent. It will use the backend handler. I generally prototype on a single server. When I need to go to the build farm where I have lots of machines doing my web serving, I then add this line and say, okay, now require in my actual database back handler at that point. 2 minutes left. No question. Okay. Yes. The question was, if you don't have the handle there, it's going to go to back to the default, which is files. It'll just go local files. So the app still works in the test server. Now, this slide is mostly just to show off my presentation system that it can do that. Basically, the future PHP stuff we're working on, Apache 2.0 and PHP is still not there. I know Red Hat 8 comes by default with a broken web server. Just get rid of it. RPM minus E, Apache, install Apache 1.3, install a working web server. Apache 2.0 and PHP are not there yet. It's going to take some time. The filter API in Apache 2.0 is just inherently broken. And the thread safetiness of a lot of libraries that PHP relies on is extremely questionable. So if you're going to run Apache 2.0, you have to pretty much run it in pre-fork mode, which emulates the Apache 1.3 way of doing things. So pre-forks a bunch of processes and treats requests the same way Apache 1.3 does it. But because of the filter API and the whole bucket brigade architecture of the new server, it's slower. So you end up with the same architecture, less robust, much slower. There's really no point in going to Apache 2.0 today. And I mean, it's sort of painful to say it because I'm on the Apache development team as well. I'm in the core team. I helped architect this thing, but we're not there yet. It's nice of Red Hat, I guess, to distribute the thing. It's too early though. I'm not sure why they did it. I have a feeling the next Red Hat might jump back. They probably won't. It'll probably be too embarrassing for them, but they really should because it doesn't work. Extensions to talk to everything. PHP SOAP is a bit of a push. There are two different SOAP implementations for PHP right now. They're being merged into a single one. And Parrot. You guys know Parrot? Parrot's the engine behind Perl 6. And it sort of started as an April Fool's joke. Like, why are all the scripting languages, why do they all start with PHP? They all look, all start with P, and they all look alike. PHP, Perl, Python, they sort of look the same. Let's just have a single scripting language called Parrot that does it all. It's a big, funny April Fool's thing. And now they're actually building something. I would like to see PHP running on top of the Parrot engine at some point. It's not going to happen this year or next year or even the year after that, but it would be really nice if all the scripting languages used a common base. We don't all have to solve the same problems. We don't all have to write an Oracle extension, for example. Talking to Oracle is real, real pain. And we have three different projects, Python, Perl, PHP, we're all doing it. We're all doing the same work. If we just have a single extension, drop down via Parrot back up into the extension, perfect. So I'm pushing towards that. I meet regularly with Guido and Larry and other folks as well. We talk about this. Not sure it's going to happen. I hope it will at some point. Anyway, thank you very much. I start again in about an hour and a half.